Let's go back to 2011 and look at the World Cup with Squidge. Let's go back to 2011 and look at the World Cup with Squidge.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Squidge Rugby World Cup Retrospective, the only rugby podcast you'll hear today that isn't surprised that Marcus Smith isn't in the Lions squad because he's 8 years old. However, I am joined as ever by...
My name is Will Owen and I'm also not in the Lions squad. I'm older than Marcus Smith and I've still not been selected. Although, that said, we are recording this before the announcement.
I was about to say, we're...
So I could be in the Lions squad, I just don't know that yet. I wasn't
recording this before the squad is named, so there's every chance Marcus Smith has just been named in the Lions squad just because Gatland... is somehow listening in, because he's always listening, and just wants to kind of piss us off.
Yeah.
Because that's literally the only reason Marcus Smith will be in the Lions squad.
Of course. And I guess it would also piss off Eddie Jones as well.
Yeah. Here's a question, right? Today we're going to be talking about the Australia v South Africa quarterfinal that is infamous for many reasons. If you could take any one player from this squad and put it in the Lions squad for this year, who would it
be? David Pocock.
Yeah, fair enough. Good answer.
You?
Yeah, I think it'd be David Pocock, yeah. Maybe Foy Dupree, because I think nine is more of a difficult
position.
Actually,
that's a good point. Foy Dupree, I guess, makes sense. I don't know. The thing people forget when they're selecting Lions squads, you don't have to have a bolter in there. You could just pick a normal squad of the best 15 players, so...
Yeah, it's amazing that people seem to forget that you don't have to pick... Again, Marcus Smith's the one that keeps coming up.
Yeah.
You don't need to pick Danny Kerr. You don't need to pick...
Sam Simmons.
You know, yeah, the only one, I said this the other day, but the only one I feel any chance of considering is Jack Nowell.
Yeah. I barely consider him a bolter. Like, he is such a good player.
The other thing is, you know, this is out of date by the time this goes out.
Yeah.
And
should we stop talking about
here
the
to discuss? Yeah. Yes. So, this is, of course, South Africa team, though. We are going to be discussing who had beaten the Lions a couple of years earlier.
Yeah.
Which very much served as the highlight of the Peter de Villiers era.
Yes.
But then it all led up to this World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
And they led into a Rugby World Cup where they were pretty hot and cold, I think. They played some really outstanding rugby. They played some rugby where they were lucky to win games.
Yeah.
Twice, two of their pool games.
Wales and Samoa.
They scraped through.
I think they did deserve to beat Wales.
Yeah.
I think by the slightest of margin. I think the thing is, right, if we listen back to the episode on that, there's every chance I might have said on that Wales were the best team. I don't know whether or not they are, but either way, South Africa deserved to win it because they were mentally stronger. Like, that's the bottom line of it. And the Samoa game, they were lucky to win.
Yeah,
I think they were a bit fitter than Samoa, so I feel like they knew how to close that game out. But
it was a typical tier one being outplayed by a tier two game.
Yeah,
in that the tier one team had a really really good scrum.
Yeah.
And B, were fitter because they were all
super,
you know, obviously the Samoa team were playing professionally at you know at their clubs.
Yeah.
But this South Africa team had been together and they'd been conditioned properly and so on in a way that Samoa had issues getting everything together and, you know, sliding into the right kind of team setup.
Yeah. So South Africa, as I say, super experienced. They'd won it was pretty much the scraps of the team that won the 2007 World Cup and had beaten the Lions in, you know, a test series in 2009. So this is a South African team who is used to winning. And frankly, let's look at the South African team. Why don't we?
Yeah. So this was the most capped 15 any team put out in the World Cup.
Right. Would it have been the most capped team, like, ever to have played a test match at this point?
I don't know that for certain.
Right. Because I'm pretty sure that Springbok team eventually hit that stat before.
But,
now, Wales have done it a couple of times since, haven't they?
Robbie D, in 2015, the team that played Japan was the most experienced team that ever
fielded. Okay.
Robbie Deans afterwards referred to it, said that was the most experienced team that played in this World Cup.
Right.
You know, and they're beaten by, you know, like the youngest, which is what we had out.
Yeah. So, I mean, speaking of the players who won the 2007 World Cup, the core of the team, you've got Jean de Villiers, you've got JP Peterson, Brian Habana, the leader John Smith, and Victor Matfield, who was the vice captain at this point. It's a really, really strong, sort of the core of the team, and Scott Berger as well, who we've mentioned on a few previous episodes, was having a really, really good World Cup and just physically dominating everybody. It's a properly formidable Springbok team, and least of all, as you mentioned, Foy Dupree, the master tactician.
Yeah, there is a really interesting change, though, in that they dropped Tendai Tarua.
He was injured.
They said he was dropped.
On the pre-match thing, Martin Gilliam said he wasn't fit.
We both heard from the same person different things.
Yeah.
Okay. Right, okay, so the Beast definitely wasn't playing either way.
Yeah.
But it didn't matter because they were completely on top in the scrum.
Yeah. And of course, Franz Steyn was out injured as well.
Yes.
So Pat Lamb became in at fullback, who I assume is the youngest person in this squad. I mean, he was
20 years old
at this point. So it's a lot of pressure to come in. Again, supposedly Harfany made his first start at fullback in the quarterfinal. But, you know, it's a pressurised situation to come in. But
yeah.
I think he knew that alongside JP Peterson and Mornay Steyn that they'd probably have him covered quite a lot.
But the other thing is JP Peterson was carrying an injury.
Oh, was it?
And he'd been rushed back for this game.
Right, I didn't know.
Yeah, that he wasn't due to be fit until the following week. But they kind of went, okay, he can run, we're going to play him.
Yeah.
And in the end, he ended up playing 80 minutes.
Yeah,
They took the chance on him. They took a gamble.
So they left Gio Aplon on the bench for the full game.
Yeah.
Who had a really good game against Namibia in the pool stage. But I suppose he hadn't really played in the big games, had he? So I guess it makes sense.
We'll get onto this, but they do bring Franco Hugo on the wing,
yeah,
which is an interesting one. Whereas, should we look at the Wallabies team?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's.
So, I mean, it's pretty much that set out back line. There's one point on commentary where our good friend, your good friend of mine, Andy Gormasol, who was commentating, says the Australian back line is definitely number one in the world, behind only New Zealand.
So it's number two in the world.
Which says to me he can't count, so maybe it wasn't all the money in the world, it was a fiver.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe it was like, he's the second richest man in the world, Andy Gomesall.
Yeah. I had some of the money from the world.
Yeah. Oh man, that's finally put an end to that saga. But then again, somehow Karis Williams did get all of that money.
All the money in the world. So
somehow she has all of the money in the world. So
Andy Gomesall can't count, so all we know is he had some money that he put on it.
But that is now somehow, whether it was all of it or a little bit of the money that exists in the world, that now belongs to Karis Williams. That's all we know.
His problem was that he couldn't count very well, rather than the fact that he didn't look at it and go, they don't have a back line.
Yeah.
Or, you know, their back line is number 24 in the world out of 20 teams.
Yeah.
It was, no, I can't remember which is bigger, one or two.
Yeah. And that's fine.
That's fine. You know, we
sometimes
all have that.
Yeah, I do that quite a lot.
Yeah,
so
I don't know to this day.
Yeah, me neither. This is my number two problem in the world. So here's a fun stat about the Australian backline. All of them, apart from Digby Ioane and Pat McCabe, are still playing.
Yeah. I mean, most of them playing MLR.
Yeah, but exactly. That's the thing, they could have put Matt Gitto in at 12, and that stat would stand up a little bit better. I mean, they didn't put Matt Gitto in at 12, which was a bad idea. But
it's amazing at the time you're saying this was the end of Matt Gitto's career, and he's still playing 10 years later.
Yeah. Yeah, for the Giltinis, though, so not a fan. But yeah, no, it's a star-studded Australian backline.
For anyone wondering, the Australian backline is Will Genia, Quade Cooper, centres Pat McCabe and Adamashley Cooper, wings Digby Ioane and James O'Connor, and Kirtley Beale at fullback.
That's a fire backline, isn't it?
It's
so good. And like, I did get a point during this game where I just kind of looked at this Australian team and thought, like, you wouldn't blame somebody at this point in the tournament for thinking they can win the World Cup, would you?
Yeah. Because, like, they absolutely could.
This team beat New Zealand in the Tri Nations, so like they could do that when New Zealand have had a couple of injuries. It was a proper World Cup contender team, and we've not really addressed them as that so far in this tournament, I don't think.
Have we not?
But they were proper contenders at this point.
They were ranked number two in the world going into the World Cup.
Yeah.
And they were probably up there as one of the favourites. And hence why the game that this eventually sets up, the semi-final between Australia and New Zealand, is an even bigger game than usual.
Yeah.
Because you went, actually, this is an Australian backline that can score from anything
point. So they lost that game to Ireland, which was a big one. You know, that was that sacrificed a lot of momentum for them. But you feel like if they can close out a game like this against the Springboks, they can probably beat anybody. Because, as I say, this is such a good Springbok team. This is one of the greatest Springbok teams, arguably.
And to get into it, the first half, Australia very clearly learning the lessons from that Ireland game.
Yeah.
And that's what you want from a team that
loses
the big
game.
They
start don't they?
Yeah. But they're playing as an exact reaction to how they played against Ireland. Against Ireland, they tried to chuck the ball about.
Fascinating, isn't it?
They tried to play like how they'd beaten the All Blacks when they played them earlier that year, how they'd won basically every game they won over the last couple of years, which is through using that back line, through passing the ball about a lot, through really working all of the opposition players into being both unfit and unsure of where they're supposed to be standing because they can't possibly cover, you know, just how good this Australian back line are. And instead, here, Will Genu is kicking the lever off the ball. They're being really calm and controlled and tempered, and they're not playing the kind of rugby that you expected from them. Like, pre-match, ITV say this could be the match of the tournament, you know, proper clash of styles and blah, blah, blah. And it is that, but it's the other way around to what we're expecting.
Yeah.
Because whilst Australia are playing incredibly conservative rugby, but they're still they're counter-attacking, which is a really interesting decision because that's where the space was at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, space opened up on kick return.
Yeah.
And so they really, really attacked it from first phase and from you know, counter-attack on kicks. And those were the moments where they played loose. And the rest of the time, they tightened up right away, just as they didn't do against Ireland, or really cost them against Ireland. Whereas the Springboks were offloading all the time in that first half.
Yeah.
Like, they had several points where they just threw five or six offloads in a row that were eventually knocked on. Even if they made ground, even if they made breaks, they eventually just kept going and going and going until they knocked it on. And were just getting... Even when they were getting somewhere, they were getting nowhere.
Yeah. So a lot of the South African game was just about putting a load of pressure on the Wallabies because with a back line of players like this, they're bound to make a mistake at some point. There's this great point quite early on in the game where Jean de Villiers gets the ball on the right wing and chips it down the line, and Will Genia just fields it as though he's in the opposition half, and he's so cool about it, and he feeds Quade Cooper, who clears the lines. And it's one of those sides, you didn't really see that to this Australian side that much, you know?
Yeah.
You think of them for their flashy offloading game and so on, but they occasionally pull out moments like that, which is what wins a quarterfinal, you know?
And they also have, and we see it particularly in the second half when they have almost no ball.
Yeah.
But they use all of Cooper, Berrick Barnes when he comes on, O'Connor and Beal as kicking options.
Yeah.
They have them all set up and they have them all slot in and, you know, chip the ball and clear the ball and do whatever kind of kick they're... But it's not all on Cooper or all on Barnes when he comes on.
Yeah.
It's equally balanced throughout the four, so it's really hard for the Springboks to measure.
I actually think that Australia probably should have kicked off nine a little bit more. I think they should have actually...
They do a fair bit.
Yeah, no, but I do feel like there's a couple of times, like there's one where they're caught on their own try line and James O'Connor tries to sort of dance out of trouble. No, it was Quade Cooper tries to dance out of trouble a little bit. James O'Connor saves the ruck and on their own try line. And Will Genia just spends the whole time looking for somebody to pass to in the pocket. And instead he picks the ball up, runs side to side a little bit, gets forced behind his own try line and can't clear it. And the Springboks end up getting a put in. But no, as I say, like Mornay Steyn had a great first half as well. Like he was constantly putting all the Wallabies back in their own half.
I think he did, but I don't think that's necessarily why.
Right.
The famous example is 2007 Wales v Fiji.
Yeah.
When Wales get absolutely suckered into playing the way Fiji wanted them
to.
And it becomes like almost a chuckabout on the beach in Fiji. And Fiji win that game because Wales play absolutely into their hands.
Yeah.
No, Australia weren't playing like they normally do. Australia were not trying to make it that kind of game.
No.
Yet South Africa got suckered into it. And South Africa kind of clearly had it in their heads. Everyone was bigging it up and they're probably doing all the analysis sessions in the week going, okay, they're going to play really fast and really open. We need to do that in order to stop them.
Mm.
And so they did not play to their strengths at all in the first half. It was a bizarre performance of them just playing. They weren't playing into the opposition strengths. They were playing what the opposition strengths would have been if they tried to use them instead of playing to their own or playing to the opposition's weaknesses.
I semi agree. I think there was occasionally you got a few great South African phases where they would have, ironically, they'd have big forwards throwing fancy offloads and the faster backs making really hard carries.
Yes.
So it's kind of the opposite way around to what you'd expect the Springboks to do. But it was quite effective and they were getting into the 22. And then typically David Pocock would happen.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing, right? And I think we'll get
on
to that.
We will come on to that, yeah.
I think I want to kind of talk about, I guess, their general approach to the game before we get into the...
Yes.
The thing this game is famous for, which is Bryce Lawrence, David Pocock, and all that.
Yes.
So should we run through the game quickly in terms of sort of what happens? Because the first 10 minutes are quite back and forth in terms of territory.
Yeah.
And the stat comes up that prior to the first try, the only try of the game, the Springboks had 83% possession.
Yes.
Which is insanely high, but that's also partly because the Wallabies don't want it.
Yeah.
And they're very happy to kick it away and just let the Springboks play in their own half.
It's really weird because you don't consider this Wallabies team the sort of team that are happy to defend, you know?
Yeah.
You think of them, as I say, counter-attack. That's everything, you know? Kurtley Beal has this really nice counter-attack where he steps a few people and he does this nice little switch with Stephen Moore and they get into the 22. There's moments like that, which is what you associate this Wallabies team with. But I suppose it is effective that they have a very attacking backline. And they have David Pocock, who basically their entire defence just basically structured around eventually David Pocock getting his hands on the ball. It was super interesting.
I mean, it works.
It works. And yeah, super well.
But as I said, like the only times they were really attacking, in inverted commas, was off counterattack. You know, it was the Springboks kick very loosely.
Yeah.
And neither teams chase their kicks very well in this game. They sometimes have an individual player who chase after it.
I agree with that.
Like, there's a point in the second half in particular where there's absolutely no chase and the Springboks just don't use their advantage.
I actually think they could have put a lot more pressure on Pat Lambie, the Wallabies. Yeah.
Oh, they should have. They should
Pat Lambie have, really, had a much easier day than he probably thought he was going to have.
Yeah. So the Wallabies keep kicking. They I think Quade Cooper puts in... Quade Cooper has a very un-Quade Cooper moment where he makes a breakthrough, then pins the ball into the corner.
Yeah, was this when Pat McCabe stripped John de Villiers? Yeah. Yeah, no, that
And
was...
he's in some space. Quade then, instead of going
dance, really sensible moment from Quade.
Which is a new sentence, brand new sentence, no one has said up until that point.
Phenomenal kick.
The other thing about Quade, you know, all the stuff about Quade being enemy number one.
Let's talk about this.
Yeah, so Quade's first involvement in the game, from the kickoff, which he takes, South Africa boot it back long, and Quade Cooper is under it, and he fumbles it backwards.
Yeah.
There is a massive jeer from the crowd.
Everyone loves it.
They absolutely love it. But before he runs back to pick the ball up, Quade Cooper turns and looks at the crowd.
Does he?
Yeah. So he clearly has a moment of registering that.
Right.
And that gets into his head.
Because the whole World Cup, obviously... As you say, he was literally public enemy number one in New Zealand.
He was, like, yeah.
That was
he was named less popular than Osama bin Laden.
Yes. He was number two, wasn't he?
No, I think he was number one. He was number one.
No, as in bin Laden was number two.
Oh, number two. Yeah, bin Laden was number two. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And I think Graham Henry was number three?
That's according to Andrew Gomesol.
Yeah.
Who said Osama bin Laden, yeah.
Yeah, and then I love that because he drops the ball backwards and then he starts lining up a kick into the opposition half. And the transition from jeering to booing from the crowd is so quick. It's so well rehearsed. I love it.
That's a crowd that have been to amateur theatrics plenty of times.
Yeah, yeah. That is a lot of fun. The ups and downs of Quade in this game. Because there are those moments where Quade does something well and the crowd are just kind of silent. They're not applauding the fact that he's done this brilliant kick. They're just kind of like, oh, fuck.
Quade, you get those, like, good. The handful of Australians in the crowd going... But it sounds so muted next to the sheer silence of everyone else going.
Everyone's against him. So he puts that kick into the South African 22.
Yeah.
And South Africa win the line out and they try to exit via, is it Scott Berger?
Scott Berger carries him.
With. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, David Pocock kind of comes in, not in the side, he comes through the middle and then hooks the ball back so it squirts out the ruck.
Pocock comes in. And as someone's trying to clear him out, he angles his body round and then boots the ball out the side of the ruck.
It's clever, isn't it?
It's really clever.
5 minutes. Like, he picked his battle well, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, the amount of time... He could have tried that in the middle of the field, and it wasn't... It's not legal, don't get me wrong.
No.
But the South African pack could have been wiser to that.
For reference.
Well, you can hook it back still.
Of course you can, yeah.
But... Like, the South African pack might have been wise to that. I might have thought, right, watch Pocock's feet. We're just going to nail him onto the floor, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he picked his battle well, did it 5 metres out from the line, made sure there was no guards ready for the box to swoop that up.
The other interesting thing about it as well is that never happens because in that situation, a team like the Springboks, and they do in this case, always send in loads of support to the ball carrier.
Yeah.
right? So only Pat McKay was making the tackle, and Pocock's there as tackle support, you know, just in case he's needed. Pocock then enters the breakdown, and there's like four South African forwards on him, plus Foyi Dupree is already slotted into scrum half.
Yeah.
And they all go, there's absolutely no way he's winning this, and especially when his body's upright, they then aren't looking at his feet.
Yeah.
And he you know, spars the ball out. Radiki Sarmo picks it up, offloads to, sorry, it's McCabe, so I suppose it must have been Nelson making the tackle.
Big Deaky picks it up. Yeah.
Then Pat McCabe crashes it up.
Yeah.
And he is, you know, it's that quick transition of attack into defence.
It's so good, isn't it? It's a really, really good transition. Yeah. I think Samo's exactly the man you want picking that ball up as well, because it's so hard to get a dominant shot on him when you're transitioning into defence. I think it's so hard to wrap the ball up at that point, because he's not only quick, but he's freakishly tall and a really good offloader. So he manages to offload to McCabe.
Is what you're saying.
Yeah, he's Fijian. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Thank you for... That's the word I was looking
Just to boil it down into one word.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and then Pat McCabe rides that tackle brilliantly, doesn't he?
Mm. And manages the free and arm for James Orwell, the captain, who is just riding around the corner, you know, just working around to get into his position in defence, realises, actually, I'll take an offload, I can score, crashes over. And the game was so tight either side of that.
Yeah.
But there's this one moment of just chaos caused by David Pocock.
It's a really easy try, isn't it?
When it is.
Think, you know, for a World Cup quarterfinal, you know, I think the box would have been really disappointed by that, to concede a try like that. Again, it's Pocock's brilliance making the ball squirt out. That's ultimately what the try comes down to, because at that point they've got to make 4 metres.
Yeah.
And against a disorganised defence, no matter how good they are, it's a lot easier than most World Cup quarterfinal opportunities will be. But this properly feels like, and you got it from the first 5 minutes, it felt like a test match with no tries, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. This felt like there's at most one try apiece.
Yeah.
Like, you could tell that.
Yeah, you could tell from basically the first whistle that this was going to be a very low scoring game. Also, speaking of, there's a moment where on the commentary, Martin Gillingham says, Ben Alexander, not many props score as many tries as him. Do you know how many tries Ben Alexander scored in his career?
2.
He scored 4 tries in 72 tests.
I mean, that's a lot of tries.
Yeah. I don't know if that's more than 1 or 2, but...
You ask Andy, you know, that's what he's there for.
Yeah.
The other thing that interesting happens around this try is the conversion.
Yes.
So, James O'Connor... James O'Connor has that really distinctive kicking routine where he kind of leans forward a bit, like he puts his knee down forward.
Mm.
And some referees will take that, as happened with Peter Stringer, as starting your run-up.
Yeah.
Same thing happened to Joe Simmons quite recently, because he has a similar thing.
To clarify, he leans forward. You just referenced it there, but for anybody who hasn't seen it, there's a clip on YouTube of James O'Connor himself kicking for the against the Barbarians, and Peter Stringer actually takes that as his run-up and runs up and nicks the ball off and runs off into the tunnel for half-time.
Picks up the ball off the tee.
Part of that is Stringer being a lovable prick, but as well, like as you say, a lot of referees will interpret that as a step forward. Just to clarify, I know that you said that, but just in case anyone hasn't seen it.
Yeah, and so O'Connor does that, and Jake Peterson sees this as his opportunity to start his run-up. He begins sprinting. The referee then lets O'Connor... you know, kind of says no, lets him run straight past O'Connor. He then just like lingers around James O'Connor, you know, like hanging off him a cigarette, any of that.
Yeah, probably whispering
while he's lurking.
To him, you know.
Yeah.
Ghost stories.
Yeah, Big Deaky fancies you.
Yeah.
Do you know who my team fancies you? Piers Spies. And then eventually James O'Connor misses it.
Yeah.
And there was some talk of should the referee have allowed him to retake it. I think that was a fair compromise of letting him run past him.
I agree.
Not charge it down, then take the shot, and he misses.
Yeah. Considering he was actually quite close to the referee, so if he was doing anything untoward, Bryce Lawrence probably would have picked up on it.
And then not penalised anyway.
Yeah. O'Connor missed the kick, which was very gettable, I think it's safe to say. For a kicker of his quality, you'd probably expect him to get it, but he missed. So the Wallabies were, 5-3 up at this point?
5-0 up.
5-0 up. 5-0 up, yes. So they then score a penalty not long afterwards.
To go.
Habana doesn't roll away from... James Hall does a brilliant carry where they overthrow the line out.
Okay. Yes, he does. James Hall was fantastic in this game.
He is.
James
really
Hall
good,
played really, really... like, one Hall, of the best
Hall,
games
Hall, Will and Vickerman
had.
Both have really, really good games.
Yeah. And what we'll get onto it later, but like I think there's only 2 contenders for Man of the Match, but I think James Hall has one of the best games I've ever seen him play.
Yeah, I agree.
I think he's unbelievably good.
Yeah.
and like makes Victor Matfield look ordinary, which does not happen very
often. I really like this Australian boiler room because Vickerman would do sort of the nuts and bolts, would catch the kickoffs and the lineouts, call the lineouts and everything. And then Horwood would do the hard carries, the big clear outs. I think they really complemented each other as a second row partnership, that Vickerman would do, get his head down and do the stuff no one likes to do. And Horwood would do the, not the flashy stuff, but the big boiler room stuff.
Yeah. And then they could bring Nathan Sharp on for his 99th cap off the bench.
Whoa, what an axis that is.
Yeah. To just be angry and big.
Yeah.
And Nathan Sharp is one of those people that you know you wouldn't mess with, but actually seems like probably quite a nice guy, you know? Yeah. Like, and whether or not you'd go up to him depends on his mood, and you could tell by looking at his face whether you'll have a good time that evening or whether you're going to be scared.
Yeah.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Yeah. No, that's probably fair enough. Yeah, so Australia overthrow a lineout, and usually you expect if somebody overthrows a lineout, it'll be to a number eight, but instead it's to a second row, so the Springboks aren't seeing it coming.
Because he's over the top of it,
And it makes sense.
Or Dupree every year, but there's no way he's getting back to it.
Yeah, and then I think Pat McCabe flies in, and a couple of the Wallabies pack fly in and really propel him forward, and they send him sort of into the South African 22, don't they? And then Brian Habana, as I say, is penalised for not rolling away, and the Wallabies go 8-0 up.
Yeah, so I wonder if this is a good point to get into it. You know, we're 25 minutes in. Should we finally talk about the thing?
We've
warmed up
a
bit. The enormous elephant that is not blowing its trunk.
Okay. I think we will talk about this chronologically as well.
Yeah.
Because my perception of this fluctuated all the way throughout the game.
So, the thing that happened immediately after this game, right? And I remember not feeling this at the time.
Yeah.
And then the moment I saw the talk on, you know, I suppose Twitter at the time and all of the assorted, you know, like South African reaction in particular.
Yeah.
Was that Bryce Lawrence, the referee, had an absolute mare and really, really cost the Springboks the game.
People threw out the word biased quite a lot.
Yeah.
And we're talking about this is one of the big sporting scandals. Of course, we didn't see that watching it live. We didn't think this, did we?
Yeah.
It's safe to say. We had a good friend of the pod, Gareth Mason, was on to talk about South Africa against Fiji. And he said that revisiting this World Cup was a nightmare, wasn't it? He said that this really felt like the one that got away because and he felt like it was out of their control.
Yeah. And it was just unanimous kind of outright hatred. I believe there were death threats, the extent
there were.
He was receiving.
Did he retire from refereeing as a result of this?
He never refereed another test match after this. This was his last game.
Wow.
And I don't know if he retired or if he was retired.
Yeah, he certainly went off-grid after this game, whether that was because of this game or other factors, such as not wanting to referee anymore.
I did a bit of research. I've got some tweets from about the time from South African fans.
Okay, that's interesting.
So these are all from the week of the match. So some of them are from sort of that weekend. So we have, you know, someone just tweeting saying, Willem van Zyl, saying, why was the referee's boss, Paddy O'Brien, appointing a fellow New Zealander, Bryce Lawrence, in the South Africa-Argentina-Australia game to determine the semi-final opponent against New Zealand?
Right.
Which is one of those things they probably can't get round, really.
No,
I see the point they're making.
I think he's a professional and... You know, I know that it's not the same thing because it's a World Cup, but like last year during the COVID pandemic, you know, we often saw people refereeing their own country. I think these people are professionals and don't have that internal bias that we do when we watch because it's what they're paid to do. That's my opinion on it, of course.
Yeah, exactly. There was a petition started, which I can't open now to prevent Bryce Lawrence ever refereeing again.
Right.
And unfortunately, the petition didn't close. The website just... Sends me back to the beginning.
Right.
But, you know, so in one day, a Facebook page called Bryce Lawrence Should Never Referee Again gained 29,386
Jesus
likes.
Christ!
In one day. That was by 7 p.m. the following day.
29,000.
So very almost 30,000 people liked a post, liked a page called Bryce Lawrence Should Never Referee Again.
Jesus Christ. That's a lot.
Quade Cooper tweeted on the bus to the airport and off to Auckland. Sadly, Wellington's been a great place. Hashtag semis, right? Replies included, did Bryce Lawrence travel with the team? Or was he an Aussie-sponsored plane? That there were several tweets along those lines.
Wow. That's mental to think.
That tweet only got one like by Quade Cooper.
Wow.
That's weird.
That is weird.
But yeah, like they're all very, very similar. Brian Habana tweeted a photo of just him in the sun the following day, you know, of like, you know, enjoying the last day in New Zealand. And someone replies saying, I hope the South African Rugby Union is going to take legal action against Bryce Lawrence.
Jesus Christ.
You know, the Bryce Lawrence is blind in one eye, and that blind eye always seems to be facing towards the Australian side.
Wow.
If Sanzar still raised Bryce Lawrence as number one, heaven help us all. Someone saying, why is Bryce Lawrence trending? What did he do wrong? That's someone with a Kiwi flag in their name. Bryce Lawrence, you cost us. I hope you feel great. One person... Oh, okay, here's a joke. Here's a joke. You ready for a joke?
Yeah.
This from Dan Nickel. Lots of nasty stuff about Bryce Lawrence. Please give him a break. Poor man had his long-term guide dog put down on Thursday. That's actually a joke, though, so fair enough. You know, I'll give you that.
Yeah. Not a very tasteful one, but a joke nonetheless.
No, but, you know. So, yeah, there's a, like, blood and mud of the time style flow chart of him saying, you know, just give a penalty to Australia no matter what. Loads and loads of stuff along those lines.
So, let's Australia go 8-0 up. Okay, so that happens.
Yeah.
At this point, I'm kind of thinking, because there's so much discourse around the referee, that watching this game, every single decision I thought about, is that correct?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Right? So you end up, like... You end up really, really looking at every single decision, both in the context of, is that correct? And is that consistent with what he's been doing the rest of the game?
Okay, yeah. So, I mean, almost the extent, right? And I've not yet said whether or not I agree with these claims.
Yeah.
But every single time he gave South Africa a penalty, I was surprised.
Because
it was painted as though... You know that there was the Romanian referee in the...
Spain.
Yeah, Spain.
Spain-Russia. Belgium-Spain
match. And basically, the situation there was that if Spain won...
If Belgium won,
Romania qualify for the World Cup.
Yeah.
And Spain were much the better team. And the consensus is that he rigged the match... So Romania qualified.
There was like a record number of penalties given against.
Yeah, and a lot of them were incredibly questionable. I had it in mind that it was going to be exactly the same as that.
Yeah, like the try they scored and so on that clearly wasn't grounded.
Yeah,
all of this
and called back for a knock-on advantage when they made a line break, for example.
Yeah, like rugby challenge.
Yeah,
but it's an interesting one, I think, as you say, because you end up watching it under such a microscope from watching that.
Yeah.
And because there was the video that did the rounds immediately afterwards, someone uploaded the video to YouTube. That was very much the Squid Rugby of their time. Of,
sounds bad.
You know, all of the mistakes he made. Oh, I hate that guy. I can't stand him.
Oh,
you know,
yeah,
and George Ford's just paying him all the time.
Yeah.
You know, like, he only does stuff because George Ford pays him to do it. He's just always praising George Ford. There was a video about the time of every mistake he made. Made on Windows Movie Maker. I watched some of it back today, and it's so clearly Windows Movie Maker, and they use all of the different titles and so on, all of like popping in and then like doing that thing where it zooms into the corner and they have the text run along the bottom, and it looks so aged. It's great. It's like a lyrics video from 2009. I loved it.
I like that.
But it's they're pulling up specific examples, and you can probably do that in any game, because there was that stat that came out about the Premiership where something like 97% of ruck offences are missed by the referees.
Yeah.
Because you can't keep track of everything.
No.
Because there's cheating in, you know, there was cheating in something like 94% of rucks.
Yeah.
From that study.
We've had a chat about captain's challenges this weekend. We're not getting into that.
Yeah, and I kind of did that on Blood and Mud if anyone wants to listen to that the other day.
Nice.
But yeah, so you then have to come down on what was Bryce Lawrence's thing?
Yeah.
And I think there is a problem and an unfair thing in this, but it's not Bryce Lawrence's fault, but there is a little bit in Paddy O'Brien, the refereeing manager, appointing him.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is not that Bryce Lawrence refereed unfairly or anything else. The problem is that Bryce Lawrence referees in a very particular way that is actually very loose at the breakdown.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's not a strict guy in the breakdown. He is quite happy to let a jackal play.
Okay, yeah.
And
I can get on board with this theory.
So, what then? Australia had a huge advantage because Australia had been refereed by Bryce Lawrence. That was the fourth time Bryce Lawrence refereed Australia that year.
Right.
So he refereed two of their previous pool stage games and two of their games in the Rugby Championship, or the Tri Nations as it was then. So Australia had this huge advantage.
That's just
the fact they knew exactly how the referee refereed, whereas Lawrence had only refereed once the Springboks that year in the last sort of 18 months, as far as I look back.
So if I look back at this, so at the start of the game, the first scrum, the Wallabies do pretty well. It's their put in, and they go forward a little bit. Fine, play on, no penalties given or anything. Then I think it's the second scrum, the Springboks have the put in, and they march them back about 5 metres. And Bryce Lawrence gives it as a reset. Says both stood up, reset. And then the next one, they start to march forward. Bryce Lawrence says, use it. Obviously, that's completely normal. That will happen in any game.
Yeah.
But obviously, under the microscope of rewatching this, hence, it's a retrospective podcast.
Ooh.
You know, naturally, I will question that. But, as you say, the proper elephant in the room is the Australian number 7, David Pocock. Because, let's face it, you've just said all of this stuff about being used to the referee. Is there any player who knows how to play a referee as well as David Pocock at this World Cup?
The moment that shines best in that is I think it's literally the only time it happens that Bryce Lawrence tells someone to get their hands away.
Yeah.
Pocock goes in over the ball and he then says, 7 hands off. And Pocock not only takes his hands off immediately, like it's incredible reaction times, really, to process the information, do it, change everything. He then looks at the referee and almost apologises.
Yeah.
Of like he kind of like looks over to him, knows what he's doing, and gets back in position. Pocock played that referee like a fiddle.
Yeah.
You know, like he played him like the most beautiful and awkwardly whistly musical instrument imaginable.
So basically, the Springboks physically, in terms of, you know, the big brutish stuff up front, were pretty much, as a team rather than necessarily in this game, would dominate Australia in pretty much every facet other than the breakdown. The breakdown meaning pilfering rather than blasting through.
Yeah, yeah.
That is certainly the case when South Africa lose Heinrich Brosseau, who goes off injured, which he
around
is their saving
minutes.
Grace. Yeah, he's their saving grace. It's not even that, it's about 20 minutes in. He goes off injured.
Right, okay.
So their saving grace at the breakdown is Heinrich Brosseau. And he goes off injured, so suddenly they do not have a leg to stand on at the breakdown. At this point, David Pocock properly cashes in. And my theory in the first half is that there's not a bias or anything in Bryce Lawrence's head. As you say, he referees the breakdown very loosely. And David Pocock knew what to do. And he gets away with one. So it's literally about 7 inches away from the Wallabies try line. He just decides, and to be honest, I think it was a professional foul was what he was going for.
Yeah.
But he realises he gets away with it. So he keeps his hands in the ruck, presents it back to the Wallabies side. I'm pretty sure Sokobi Kepu grounds it on his own try line.
Yeah, he does. It should be his come
back. Yeah, Will Genia plays out of his 22 with his own O'Connor try line, in fact, with James O'Connor, clearing the ball eventually.
Yeah.
So David Pocock realised he could get away with that once. And
so
he kind of kept going double or nothing, wasn't he?
I think it starts earlier than that.
You reckon?
About 8 minutes in, Australia clear from their own 22 after obviously looked like a legal turnover. No, it was a knock-on. Sorry, knock-on. And then Rocky Elsom makes a off the chase. I think it's a banner is hit hard, and then Rocky Elsom makes a completely illegal turnover from the ruck.
Right.
Bryce Lawrence stood next to it, but also stood next to it is David Pocock.
Right.
And Pocock clearly looked at it and went, this guy is not going to referee the breakdown.
Yeah.
I am going to cash in.
Yeah.
So Elsom goes completely off his feet, seals off the ball, you know, all of this. Like, it's incredibly illegal. But the moment you see that, right, both teams have flankers there, and especially the moment that Pocock won on his own try line, which is an incredible turnover, but as you say, completely illegal.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you get away with that.
So
and the other thing is, like,
you look at Richie McCaw.
When
people say he's one of the best
exactly.
in the world because he knows how to legally get away with things that are by the book illegal. Richie McCaw, best of all time at that.
The other brilliant thing about Pocock on that turnover on his own try line is so neither of the commentators noticed David Pocock.
Yes.
So how has the referee got a chance? You know, like from a difficult angle.
Right. Yeah.
So you can't see it.
The ball
you
just happens to come out on the Wallaby's side. Who knows
on
how it got there?
On the close-up, you then see a hand appear and scoop it back out of nowhere. Pocock is hiding himself so clearly.
That's such a great point, because obviously on the second angle, you look at it and you go, well, that's super illegal, you know. His hands are all over that after it's been called as a ruck.
Yes.
And he turns that ball over. But watching that live, I thought, that's probably illegal, but I don't know that. You know?
Yeah, you can't see what he's done wrong.
How's Bryce Lawrence supposed to see that?
And he's always been very loose at the breakdown, and the Springboks do have the disadvantage of the fact that they weren't expecting it to be like this, and they're expecting Australia to be penalised, because they rightly should be.
Yeah.
But I think Lawrence is, broadly speaking, consistent. Yeah. Just the Springboks, obviously didn't have the advantage of having played under him quite a few times in the previous few months. Four times in 2 months is significant. But they also don't adapt to it quickly enough.
No.
So the first really, really illegal turnover they win is Schalkberger in the last minute. So with about 30 seconds to play, Schalkberger goes into the breakdown, is exactly what Elsom and Pocock have been doing all game, and just completely illegally strips the ball, comes up with it, and South Africa get a chance to attack in the last minute, being 2 points behind, and could have won the game. Yeah. But that's the first time the Springboks really try and abuse the laws and do that.
Which is quite rare for this Springbok team, isn't it?
But that's the thing. Like, why are the Springboks a team who are playing clean?
Yeah, it's so strange. Like, before this match, did you watch those? So we both watched the ITV coverage of this, didn't we?
Yeah, yeah.
So beforehand, they did a feature on Peter de Villiers.
Oh, man. You watched that. Okay, I was hoping you hadn't.
Yeah, okay. And basically, they grilled him quite a lot on playing on the edge, and why that, to him, is an important part of rugby. Peter de Villiers, of course, as some people will remember, defended Schalkberger after gouging Luke Fitzgerald in the seconds line test in 2009, saying that rugby is a collision sport, not a contact sport. Dancing is a contact sport. You know, if you think gouging shouldn't be allowed in rugby, let's all go and get some nice tutus from down the ballet shop. And Peter de Villiers was the sort of coach who wasn't afraid to say outlandish things, was he?
No.
And he was an enigma, is kind of how he was viewed in the rugby world at this point. But he basically briefed the ITV coverage by saying before the match, we're not afraid to play dirty. We're not afraid to play on the edge. If we have to beat them and get players sent off, then we will beat them and get players sent off.
Yeah. And yet they didn't. And that was the really weird thing, is they didn't do that. And I did actually, just on the Peter de Villiers point, I had been going to do a quiz based partly on that and partly on looking at press quotes from him from during this World Cup,
okay,
which are the real quotes, but you've seen a lot of them. So I don't know if I just want to read you some quotes.
Go on, do it. Yeah.
Okay. And, some of these might not be Peter de Villiers' quotes. Tell me if you think they're not.
Okay.
It's not going to be a formal quiz.
Okay.
Okay. There's one point in that clip where someone compares him to Martin Luther King.
Yes.
Which was
it's a stretch, isn't it?
So Peter de Villiers said in that ITV clip, 75% of the people in the world are mad.
Yeah. That was a Peter de Villiers quote. Can confirm. Which
I think is, broadly speaking, true. The more success you get, then people will criticise you. They'll criticise your voice, they'll criticise your moustache, which he really emphasised. They will look for all the little flaws in your life.
Yes. I enjoyed that one, because he said that like as a piece of advice, like specifically your moustache, regardless of whether or not you have one.
Yeah, yeah. It's really just advice for Ted Lasso, isn't it?
I'll tell you what, Ted Lasso would not defend Schalkberger for gouging eyes.
No, oh, absolutely not.
He would put him on the naughty step.
he would get Roy Kent on him. This is a quote from early in the tournament. I'm a God-given talent. I'm the best I can be. So what you think doesn't bother me.
Is this are these 1975 lyrics?
They could be, yeah. Fruit, it isn't just apples and pears. There are prickly pears as well. We want to be a prickly pear, which I think is late period Morrissey.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Yeah, that is a Peter de Villiers quote, can confirm.
All sport is dangerous. Look at the fast bowler. What's his first job? It's to take your head off. He wants you to die, but passion, that goes with it.
That's just not true. His job is to bowl fast. He's a fast bowler. Yeah. Not a mad axeman.
He wants to behead you, mate. He wants to behead you. He's like that guy in the third Harry Potter who has the Big Mac axe.
Yeah.
The Big Mac axe. He's just got a massive, massive...
He's just been to Mackey's.
Yeah. He said, I'm a born leader as well, which I think is a solid one. He said, my players will follow me blindly.
Yes, which probably isn't a good thing.
There's a couple of... Is this a real quote about the Samoa game? Because you won't have seen this on the coverage.
Okay.
A sweet rawness, feeling bruised and scratched up, hypnotic, life is sensual, not fix it in post.
I think that's like David Bowie.
It's not. It's a poem written by Pamela Anderson.
Okay.
But then the best bit of that whole section, that whole segment, is at the end. The
when he says, I'm the cream of the crop, I rise to the top.
To the top. I never eat a pig because a pig is a cop. There's a bit where the interviewer asks him, do you want to stay on the Springboks coach? And he goes, don't think so.
Yeah, I love that. And he said, like,
right before a quarter final.
He says, like, I don't think so, but, you know, that's the board's decision. You know, if they want to keep me, then fair enough. Like, he's bracing himself for getting sacked if he loses.
Yeah.
But he's basically just saying, it's a proper, like, no, she didn't break up with me, I broke up with her moment.
Yeah.
You know? But, like, in advance of the breaking up.
In the post-match press conference, he then says, you know, it's been a great journey, blah de blah de blah, you know, I'm really proud of what I achieved, all of this. Like, he hasn't been fired yet, but he basically says,
yeah,
see you, lads, I'm off. I'm not doing this again. I'm going to go and try and coach the Kings, but then not have a work permit. In, like, 10 years' time.
Yeah, yeah. It does feel slightly crazy that he's still coaching rugby, doesn't it? It feels slightly crazy that he's still about, but...
He was a... He's such an interesting character.
Memorable,
interesting guy. Like,
isn't he? Yeah.
I would read a book on him.
Yeah. No, he's,
you know, like he's one of those guys. Yeah.
Like, for the right or wrong reasons, he's fascinating, isn't he?
Exactly. There's so much sort of there in his career, in who he was, because he was so confident. And his and the point he makes in that clip of he really wanted to coach the Springboks because he wasn't allowed to play for them when he was a player because of apartheid.
Yeah.
You know, and that was always his dream. He didn't get to do it, so he was coaching them instead.
Yeah.
And also, you know, as he says, 75% of the people in the world are mad.
Yeah, that's valid. And therefore, 10 out of the 15 Springboks team, in fact, that's two-thirds. What the fuck am I on about?
Yeah, hey, 75% of the people in the world are mad.
Yeah.
To link back to things there.
Yeah. So, there's a point. I'm aware that we're 47 minutes in, we've not reached half-time yet. But
that's fine.
It's a big game. It's a big game. So it's worth discussing. And to be honest, I'm going to level with you guys. It's mostly going to be rugby we talk about this time round. We're going to struggle to work around that. There's a point, 24 minutes in, where David Pocock gets a turnover. I've written my notes. I genuinely don't know the rules of rugby anymore, but I know David Pocock is good at it. Well, I genuinely have no idea if that's a legal
turnover.
There are
a couple of those turnovers, and normally I'm quite solid on the breakdown.
Yeah.
You know, like I feel like it's one of the things... I don't understand scrummaging. I feel like I understand sort of... I'm solid on the breakdown, you know? Like, I'm not Sam Warburton, but I'm solid. If you were tuning and thinking...
You can have an instinct on a breakdown, can't you? I think we both have that.
There's a few of them where you look at them and you go, like, I'm sure that's illegal, but I don't know what law is broken.
Yeah. And that one ruck, I had genuinely no idea. So rarely has a breakdown mystified me to that extent. Like, it's not even one of those where you look at it and go, oh, that could go either way. It's just, I genuinely have no idea what David Pocock did, no matter how many times I watch it, or whether or not that is legal. I can't figure
out. There's another one where I looked at it and my brain went, that's illegal. Then I went, then on the replay went like, oh, it isn't. No, my brain just conditioned me to think every turnover he makes is illegal now.
There is one where I think it's the third or fourth turnover he makes in the first half, which is a mad sentence to say, where I kind of have written down, like, Pocock wins his fourth turnover. This one is legit.
I've also, so there's one he wins when Springboks putting a lot of pressure on. They put for a kick and they're really bearing down on the line. You know, it looks like they're going to score.
Yeah.
And then Pocock somehow, 5 metres out from his own try line, chases back after this break, gets over the ball, wins it.
Yeah.
Right? And my only thought was Victor Matfield looks at him and lets him get the breakdown.
Right.
Like, take him out off the ball. You know, like, shoulder him. Don't let him get a clean run to the ball.
Even
like,
if you fly off your feet, you know.
Yeah.
Do something to get rid of him.
Obviously, he wasn't to know he's going to win a penalty
for
this.
But
the way the game's going, your first responsibility as one of that Springbok pack should be to take Pocock out.
And,
like,
to just make sure. To seal him off.
Like, anytime he goes for Jacqueline, he doesn't get it, pin him to the floor.
Yeah.
Anytime he's running into position, make it as hard as possible. The thing Josh Navidi did to him in 2019.
Yeah.
you know, where he like held him back at every line out, where he stopped him at every scrum.
Absolutely.
Get in his way. And no
it's
one
mad
was.
That Josh Navidi's the only player who's kind of done that.
Josh Navidi is the best player in the world at cancelling out other players.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's such a weird skill.
Richie McCaw never quite managed it, did he? He had games where he played better than Pocock, but he never had a game where he completely cancelled him out.
Yeah, and I'm sure there are every... Warburton did it a lot, you know, because Wales would set him up to cancel out Pocock.
Yeah, not as well as Navidi did, in my opinion.
No, but you needed to send someone to cancel out Pocock. Yeah. And you kind of need the whole South African pack, because they were all big enough, smart enough, and bastard enough to just take him out.
Yeah. So, I mean, the Springboks had a really good phase of attack in the Wallabies 22, where Dupree put this brilliant bomb for Curtly Beale. And to be fair, Beale took it brilliantly originally, but then eventually James O'Connor knocks it on. And South Africa start going from one touchline to the other. Jacques Free slightly butchers a pass to Brian Habana, which could have set him up really nicely.
So, that's one of those rare examples. And normally when you see this, you know, the miss pass isn't on. Don't throw the miss pass. That should have been a miss pass by John de Villiers.
Yeah, I agree.
Before, you know, instead he goes to Jacques Free, then down the line. I looked back at that, and I don't think John de Villiers is comfortable throwing that wide and that flat a miss pass.
Yeah, maybe.
I think he's wanting to do it because he's looking at Habana, he's wanting to do it, and he changes the amount of pass to Free. And I don't know if he's just too flat and he can't, you know, he can't.
I think
get it
probably his
him.
Body angle's a bit off, isn't it?
Is in Fourie's is off, Fourie's would be in the way and block it. But de Villiers doesn't look comfortable throwing the pass to Habana, which Habana, I'd give him like, you know, like 90% odds on finishing that.
Yeah, yeah. It was a pretty good opportunity for him. And
you look at his finish against Samoa, you look at, you know, how good he is.
Yeah, Habana on the whole did actually play quite well when he was sort of, he ran off the ball well in this game. I think he found some good holes that he was picking, because he knew that his role wouldn't be to sprint in tries from 90 metres in this game. He knew it would be to run unders lines and graft. And I think he did that pretty well on the whole.
Such an underrated part, because people talk about Habana as a finisher and as an outright speed merchant. But his positioning,
he thought
was
about
as
the
good
game so like well, didn't he? He was really, really, really smart player. Yeah. But there's another point where they go wide too. I think it is Matfield. And JP Peterson doesn't set his width. And he comes around a second too late. And again, you think that could be try time. But the Springboks don't quite get that last pass right.
Yeah, there's a few of those. But also the Australian defence is excellent consistently.
It is, yeah, yeah. They drifted and scrambled really, really well.
Yeah. And there's only really one time... Two, actually, I guess, you can't have anything. But there's once in the game where you properly think this is going to be a try.
Yeah.
And we'll get onto that in the second half.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's a really tricky one for the Springboks, because I think they... I think they are kind of stupid in the first half.
Yeah, okay.
And they're playing well, but they're tactically playing it really badly.
Yeah, okay.
In terms of how they approach the game, and also how they approach the breakdown in particular, I don't think they approach it well.
I think I know what you're alluding to. So... This story, I mean, there's one penalty where Morne Steyn has a go from just behind halfway. It's 51 metres he has to kick it. And
on
he half just
time, that's
misses.
Fine. I get it. Yeah.
There's that one earlier on as well where Quade Cooper's penalised and he has to kick it from 50 metres and he just about misses. And then there's another one, you know, Australia are 8-3 down as we approach half time. And then,
South Africa are 8-3 down.
Sorry, yeah. South Africa are 8-3 down. Thank you for correcting me. It's very important. And then. Steyn goes for another penalty, as you say, on half time, where he doesn't particularly want to go for it. But
he doesn't want to go for it. That's one of those where, as a kicker, you know you're judged by your stats.
Yeah, yeah.
And he knows he'll miss this, but he'll give
it a go. Of course, for the benefit of the listener, at this point on half time, if you have a penalty, you can't kick for touch or else that is half time. You can't take the line out. So, realistically, he was in the opposition half. He is, other than Francois Steyn, the best kicker in long range kicker in the world.
He's up there.
Francois Steyn and Lee Halfpenny were the other two, really, at this point. So Morne Steyn is the other one. And you do fancy if anyone's going to knock that penalty over from the touchline on halfway, it'll be Morne Steyn. He doesn't give it a bad go. He misses just to the right.
On the angle, it was 62 metres.
Right. That's insane.
The fact that he gives it a pretty decent shot is impressive in itself.
What I like after this as well, we're happy to hurtle towards half-time, aren't we?
Yeah, yeah.
So, just after this, Curtly Beale catches the ball and puts it down, you know, forces it for half-time. And then afterwards, John de Villiers just kind of runs up to him.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
As though he's going to tackle him. And then Curtly Beale just looks at him for a minute, goes to clip him around the ear and misses.
That's excellent. That's very, very good.
Last thing I want to say about the first part.
Yeah, cool. Okay.
Was there's a point where Radiki Sarmo nails Brian Habana. And I'm not sure there were any arms in the tackle, but it was a great shot regardless.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah.
There's a few tackles like that in this game.
Yeah,
there's
there
a few, like, tackles that would definitely be penalties, if not more, these days.
Yeah.
There's one, I suppose, that's worth mentioning late on.
Yes.
We'll get there. I don't know, did you watch much of the halftime stuff?
Yeah, I did a bit, yeah. So they had Michael Leiner and
François Pienaar.
I don't know why his name just escaped me there. So they had, Michael Leiner and François Pienaar discussing the game. And François Pienaar was pretty livid already, safe to say. Yeah. Michael Leiner was quite diplomatic as well and sort of said, yeah, we're kind of getting the rubber green, a bit at the minute. But fair play to François Pienaar, because both at halftime and after the game, he said sort of, we shouldn't be in a position where we're having to debate these things. Like, South Africa should be further ahead and should be, as you probably alluded to a minute ago, should be taking three pointers and trying to build a bit of a score.
Yeah, because they don't do that at all in the first half. But they do change up the way they're playing in the second half. And there's a very brief shot of the South African changing room. And I paused it because do you know who's having a big old word?
Razzie.
It's their coaching consultant, their technical consultant, Mr. Johan Erasmus. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And so no surprise, they then come out for the second.
Yeah.
They come out for the second half and they're playing like the 2019 team did.
Yeah.
You know, in that they're playing to their strength suddenly and they're very happy to take 3 points at any point. They're relying on their pack to get them going and the backs are only there, you know, once things open up but are used.
They tactically look like World Cup finalists at that point, the Springboks. Yeah. They look so much more on colour, more like themselves. As I say, Morne Steyn is such a good game manager at this point and has a cannon of a boot.
And I'm sure it's a coincidence that the one shot we happened to see was the moment Razzie was talking.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they do play, as you say, so much more like that 2019 team, so much like a World Cup finalist team.
Yeah.
Because the first half, they look like a really, really good team who didn't know how to use their strengths.
Yeah.
And the second half, they do. And so we see them kick a penalty from a scrum quite early on in the half.
Yes.
And then as things roll on, they get back down in the South African half, into the Australian half rather, and they knock over a drop goal really nonchalantly, really calmly, in a way that, you know, they put them 9-8 up.
There's...
in a way that just says, like, we mean business, we're here, we want to win this World Cup, not just win this game.
So we'll get to that, because this is...
Yeah, yeah. But
we'll address this chronologically as well,
Of how their game management changed completely.
Yeah, yeah. And no, that is important to set the tone.
They also, there's a couple of points straight after halftime where in the first half they would have started offloading and they would have been stringing these long passes together.
Yeah.
But instead they're playing one or two passes off nine and that is it.
Yes.
You know, that they're pretty much crashing it up into midfield and they're keeping hold of the ball.
It was an effective plan in 2011.
Yeah. But at one point they run through about 12, 13 phases.
Yeah.
And even though eventually they get turned over and Digby Ioane has a run down the wing.
Yes, let's talk about this.
Even though they lose it, I think that was a hugely positive moment.
Yeah.
Because it showed
good
their calm.
Tackle, wasn't it? Yeah.
And it showed that they're willing to wait and be patient. And that's the first time in that game that you go, if the Springboks win this, it won't be a fluke.
Yeah.
You know? Like they know what they're doing now.
Yeah. They've sorted it out. So Digby Ioane, there's this turnover, the ball spills out the ruck. And Digby Ioane picks it up and has a run down the wing. He outstrips most of the South African defence. And then Morne Steyn, I have no idea like how hard he had to work to get across there. It's an outstanding piece of defence from Steyn. So Ioane chips the ball down the wing. and Mornay Steyn so cleverly blocks him. You see this? That Steyn just throws his shoulder into him and Ioane drops to the floor.
Yeah. In a way that blatant as anything.
It's only just not penalisable. Well, it is penalisable, but he does it just enough that it's not blatant to the referee.
But the other thing is, Lawrence is so loosey-goosey on most of the laws that he will let an awful lot go, that is definitely being let go. The only worry is he does it on Romain Poit's wing, who is the strictest person out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'll get onto one of them, but throws up a few penalties that Lawrence would have let go.
Yeah.
Because he's not quite playing Steve rules, he's just, like, sort of just vibing.
Yeah, yeah. So South Africa dive on the ball, but Australia immediately blast the break down and turn it over. Mm. And then they start to go wide, and you feel like this is going to be a try for Australia. That's one of those opportunities where you feel like space is such a rare currency in a game like a World Cup quarterfinal that is as tight as this. And you feel like if you get the ball wider into the hands of James O'Connor and Alan Ashley Cooper, something is on here. But Rocky Elsom just gets in the way as I think it's James Hall was about to pass out the back to Curtly Beale.
Mm.
And the Australian forwards just get in the way. They get their timing slightly wrong and they don't quite have the opportunity to go wide on first phase. But then they go wide on the next phase. And what should happen but Quade Cooper goes for a speculative pass and Brian Habana leaps into the way and gives away probably the world's most blatant deliberate knock-on. But it's just penalised as a knock-on. Like, his arms, he looks like a starfish. So his limbs are spread at full stretch.
He's doing jumping jacks.
Yeah.
He sort of like jumps sideways and like, well, hey! Yeah. How are you doing, Gav? It's like a children's TV presenter just appearing from the side. It's like Blue's Clues, you know? When he jumps on from the side and goes, we just got a letter. We just got a letter. We just gave away a knock-on and we saved a try.
Yeah. Duh. Boy, did you get away with that. I know that the whole narrative is Lawrence.
It's smart. No, because his body language to me, seeing it live, didn't go, that's a double knock-on. He went, oh, he's unlucky.
No.
Then I kind of looked at him but then I looked at it again and went, wait a second, what was I thinking?
No, live, you think he's trying to block the pass. He's trying to block the pass. He's not trying to catch the ball. He's trying to block the pass. Like, it's as blatant a deliberate knock-on as you'll
ever
see.
But I was thinking he got his body in the way rather than...
No, it's so blatant, man. Like, it's one of those that, like...
No, I'm not disagreeing with you.
It's not a penalty try because they're quite far out and there's cover coming across, but it is a very clear yellow card. And nowadays it would definitely be given. But
weirdly, Habana then comes off very shortly afterwards.
Yeah, so he kicks the ball dead not long after this, doesn't he?
Yeah, he kicks the ball dead and De Villiers immediately brings him off.
Yeah, puts on Francois Hojot on the wing.
Before the resulting scrum.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is an odd decision, really, especially considering that JP Peterson wasn't fit.
Yeah.
There's another odd thing that Martin Gilliam says on commentary, that a lot of people are saying if the Springboks had taken this World Cup seriously and if they've got a serious chance of winning it, then the two men they need to be on the field... Those are the two men warming up now, which are Bismarck Duplessis and Francois Hougar.
That's a very strange
comment, isn't it? To start.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, Hojot was really well used as an impact player, I think, in this World Cup by the Springboks. Yeah. Obviously, he scored the winning try against Wales, and they tried that move a few times where Froy Dupri would pick two steps to the right and then just lift it to Hojot, who's running into a gap. But I think that's quite often a pre-rehearsed thing that Dupri would call a few phases in advance. Yeah, they tried that a few times. But no, it wasn't an unusual comment saying that Hojot has to start.
But Bismarck comes on and absolutely backs that up.
My God.
He was
his first
incredible.
Scrum, his first scrum, he just obliterated the Wallabies.
And then every time he touches the ball as well,
he
is, you know, he charges down the 22, regathers the ball himself and carries for 5-10 metres, you know, almost up the try. You think he's going to score himself.
Yeah.
He makes a couple of carries that are huge, where he just batters someone aside and keeps going. He was phenomenal.
Yeah. And like from that charge down in the 22 opportunity, the Springboks most certainly would have scored if not for David Pocock slowing the ball down, whether legally or not. You'd have fancied them. In fact, that wasn't long before the Mornay Steyn drop goal, was it?
No, I think
it might have been the same phase, which was so brilliantly taken. As you say, it sent them 9-8 up. So, not long after the Habana incident with the deliberate knock-on, South Africa get further downfield.
Mm.
And you know what's coming, don't you?
I do.
The opportunity that you were referring to earlier, I can only assume, which is the one opportunity South Africa had at the Australian try line where you felt like this is a try opportunity.
Yeah.
Do you want to explain it?
So, Australia have one of those moments that happens in games, and they happen less often now, but they certainly did 5-10 years ago, where the defence switches off for half a second.
Yeah.
And they don't quite rush up in the way they normally do. Mm-hmm. They kind of stand off a bit, you know, after some quick ball by Australia, by South Africa rather, after a bit of a break. And Jean de Villiers is very easily phased onto the outside of Adam Rusty Cooper and breaks the line. They scramble, they recover. Kurt Lee Beale comes up and gets in his face from fullback. But Ioane, he Digby. Manages. Oh, Digby Onu, okay. He threads the ball through to Pat Lambie, who is having to sprint onto it because there is defenders, you know, I've all around de Villiers. He's kind of he's like the centre of a D-pad, you know, of like Australian defenders around him. And he managed to thread the ball wide to Lambie, who runs in for a try. But it's funny you say it's a great pass because it is also given as a forward pass.
It's given on the spot by Bryce Lawrence, who in his defence is in line with de Villiers. He's perfectly in line with de Villiers, so we can witness the direction of the pass. However, it's still a very questionable call.
Guys, a tricky one, though, isn't it?
Super tricky. So, in the post-match analysis, they look at it, and they sort of highlight a graphic showing where de Villiers was and where Lambie catches the ball. And where Lambie catches the ball is in front of where de Villiers was when he threw the pass. So, the ball does indeed drift forward. So, it's with that logic, it's hard to argue, isn't it?
Mm.
Sometimes it's happened before.
Other advantage that they have is that they're pretty much on the 22-metre line.
Mm-hmm.
So de Villiers takes the ball on the 22-metre line. He then throws the pass like an inch in front of it.
Yeah.
And Lambie catches the ball, you know, 5-6 inches in front of it.
Yeah.
And for having those markings on the pitch, it's so much more visible to the referee.
Yeah. So it's one of those that even if you're in line with the pass, as a referee, you kind of have to be expecting a forward pass to call a forward pass there.
Yeah.
You know, you have to be thinking, right, I'm going to look and see if this is going to be a forward pass to call that, you know? It's much easier to look at a forward pass and call it as backwards than the other way around, isn't it?
Yes.
So, as you say, Lambie goes over, slides in, thinks, yep, yeah, got myself a try, and then gets up and realises the whistle's been blown and is mystified by this. Andy Gomersall actually makes a really good point on commentary and says that Digby Ioane flying in out of view and smashing Jean de Villiers means that he is then stood still, which makes the pass look more forward because he is then rooted to the spot. Lambie is flying onto the ball. The ball is going to look like it's travelling forwards because if de Villiers keeps travelling, it looks like he's travelling in line with the ball or the ball's even maybe even going behind him. So fair play, Andy Gomersall. That's a great point about Ioane's tackle.
Yeah, yeah.
That it makes the pass look forward. But I do feel like the movement of the hands is backwards. So I think
it's tricky to say because...
It is.
I think it's very lateral, the movement of his hands.
Yeah.
And I think he's trying to throw the ball incredibly laterally because of how close...
Yeah.
I guess it'd be O'Connor, who's outside him.
Someone like that.
Is. Whoever the defender between him and Lambie would have been.
Yeah.
Is really, really flat between them.
Yeah.
And is really much in line. But I think he's trying to throw it impossibly laterally that it probably does drift forwards. Yeah.
So,
but it's such a close call. And the problem is, right, the reason this looks then unbalanced... Beyond, you know, the breakdown stuff, which Australia were abusing the laws when South Africa weren't. Australia don't have a call like this. Their try comes from, obviously, you know, the Pocock cheats the breakdown.
Yeah, yeah.
But that becomes part of another issue. There isn't a decision like this for Australia that gets ruled out.
No,
there
like
isn't a clear-cut chance.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, they don't create any chances, really, Australia.
No.
They get into the 22 again, I guess. But there isn't a controversial call.
The closest thing is that Habana
doesn't go their way.
Call. But that's not something that was talked about.
I don't think that's the same.
Yeah, it's not the same level as this. So the thing is, my opinion on this Lambie try is that if that was scored today, the TMO wouldn't be checking that as a forward pass. I think that he would have just that the TMO would just let that go. He or she would let that go. But
I was thinking this: the referee would have given it as an on-field try nowadays.
Yeah.
But it would have been then reviewed and probably given because it's too close a call.
Yeah.
I think
it's difficult to conclusively overrule it, isn't it? But what matters is...
The other thing is, though, this stadium didn't have a spider cam, which would have shown us for certain.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Whereas a World Cup quarterfinal nowadays would be played in a stadium for spider cam.
Yeah.
So we would have that and we would see that.
Of course, what matters is that the ball does go forwards from where Jean de Villiers passed the ball to where Lambie caught the ball. It was given as a forward pass. The try does not stand. That is what matters. You know, I don't know whether or not I agree with it. So, because it was given, let's say I agree with it. Okay? So, we'll get on with it.
It's a really, really tricky It's a really tricky one to take a position
on. It's difficult to say whether or not you agree or not, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a super controversial call. Like, it's very questionable, but fair play, Bryce Lawrence having the balls to just straight up just say, no, that's forward, I'm not giving that.
Mm.
But the kick in the teeth is a minute later when Jacques Ferry passes the ball to Brian Habana, and I just thought, Jesus Christ, Bryce Lawrence has called that one forward again. And it was so marginal, and Habana has a bit of a run down the touchline. It's not
it's insult to injury, isn't it?
Yeah.
No.
Properly insult to injury.
And because that one just looked backwards to me.
Yeah.
But he calls it as forwards, and I think it's flat.
It's a proper kick in the teeth, isn't it?
Yeah.
I really felt for the Springboks at that point when that was given twice in a row. And they did look slightly defenceless. You know, they looked... We spoke about when the Samoa Springboks team game, when there was like a bit of a victim complex for the Samoans for like most of the game.
Yeah, yeah.
There was that for like the next 2 minutes for the Springboks. They're just like, come on, give me a break, you know? They did eventually get on with it. As you say, Bismarck came on. And, you know, that was a pretty big one. I mean, Barrett Barnes came on as well for Pat McCabe, who had put his body about, man. Like, he'd flown into so many collisions.
Pat McCabe was good.
Yeah. At the time, I didn't appreciate how good Pat McCabe was.
No, I didn't. I remember this being the game where he won me over, though.
Yeah.
Prior to this, I was a bit like, oh, what's Pat McCabe doing there? Why can't he pick Matt Gutter?
Yeah.
But then watching this game, you're going, actually, he's...
He flung himself about a little bit, and respect to him, you know? And I guess, like, he predates System 12s, but he kind of played that role a little bit and was just very, very much a defensive leader, would fly into, you know, forward collisions if he had to. And fair play to him, he put his body on the line, so, you know, respect to him. But eventually that took its toll on him, and they brought on Barrett Barnes, which tactically is a good change as well.
Yeah.
You know, gives you an extra pair of hands and a good right foot, you know, left foot even. So, that was when there was the Bismarck charge down.
Yeah, so we're then coming up on the South Africa take a drop goal.
Yes. So well taken. It's a majestic drop goal from Monastir.
Just really calm. Yes, really
so
calm. A lot like the La Rochelle one last weekend.
Yeah.
In that they just knew what they were doing, just very calm, just went bam, you know, we'll take the points.
It's the phase before everybody, all the fans watching, start thinking, oh, we could go for a drop goal. It's the exact phase before everyone starts to say that. Mornay Steyn just slots into the pocket and straight away just really nonchalantly knocks it over. And it's so calmly taken. And again, you're thinking, this fly off the World Cup finalist here.
And at this point, the Wallabies then start to panic.
Yeah.
Suddenly start to implode. So Quade Cooper puts a ball out in the full.
Yeah.
They start running from the 22 and they knock it on. They just lose that composure they previously... The only player that still looks composed is Will Genia.
Yeah.
Will Genia then... Because you can't kick every single phase as a scrum half, he sort of looks almost reluctant whenever he has to pass to Cooper.
I know what you mean.
And he almost looks like he just wants to be hoofing it.
You know what's notable? For the first like half an hour of us recording this podcast, we only mentioned the Wallabies players. We've basically not mentioned them since. That probably says so much about the lateral flow of the game. Yeah, as you say, Quade Cooper puts that kick out on the full, and you're starting to think this is where they're going to wobble. James O'Connor makes a great take after Steyn tries to bomb him, and O'Connor manages to survive that collision somehow. There's a great moment where Willem Alberts rattles Quade Cooper in his own 22.
Yes.
And wins this turnover. You often see those and think that's a match-winning turnover, you know? Yeah.
Willem Alberts, another player that really makes an impact.
He does.
Obviously, for injury, so he, you know...
One of those where you just want a big bastard to come on. And that was exactly what they got. And he came on at number 8 for Piers Spies. So, playing in the back row. I think he'd come on earlier in the game in the second row. But he made a proper impact. And it was just one of those where you just want somebody to properly rattle the opposition pack, and he just every impact.
Yeah. You've mentioned it, so I'm going to bring up something I've got written in my notes.
Yeah.
Which is just, God, Piers Spies is shit.
I don't think he's shit.
I thought he was atrocious in this game.
Do you?
But...
He had a carryover red sideways in the 22, which wasn't great.
Not because he was making mistakes, but because he was actively doing nothing.
Mm.
It was like putting a glass of tap water in at number 8. Like, there's a... The point that really pissed me off is there's a bit in the... where the Springboks are in the opposition 22. You know, they're like 5-10 metres out from the line. And Spies is set up to carry on his own. There's no one near him and he's calling for the ball, right? Whilst the ball's still in the ruck.
Yeah.
He would have been isolated and turned over. Instead, they drop Yanni Duplessis out to carry. The ball goes to him. Spies looks kind of annoyed he isn't going to get the ball himself. He then just doesn't really bother. He stood directly behind, mm-hmm. you know, in that kind of like latch clear out position. He doesn't bother doing it.
Yeah.
And he just lets Pocock get over the ball. Like, he just stands there.
Yeah.
He doesn't make any effort to clear out. And that is just like, that is exactly the kind of player he was. That if, right, if I was Pierre Spies' build, I would have been world class. You know, like, if I had his, like, natural talents and ability, but instead he was just lazy and shite. Mm. And he really, really pissed me off watching this game, yeah. because if they'd put Willem Alberts in from the start, maybe they win this game.
Yeah, that's an interesting call. I mean, I think that, obviously, Alberts was a great finisher, to use that term.
Yeah.
I think that made sense as his role, but I know what you mean. If Dwayne Vermeulen was
oh, Dwayne, as good Dwayne as Vermeulen, they win this game. Yeah.
But, you know, I suppose it's one of those things, because obviously Spies is a really talented player, and he did play quite well in the group stage, I think, but I don't know. Yeah, I don't think he's quite as bad as...
He doesn't work.
Yeah.
He doesn't work.
Yeah.
Like, he's the anti-Faletau. All he likes doing is getting the ball and running.
I get that.
Like, he's like an under-12s player.
Yeah, a little bit. But
just because
yeah.
he's big and quick, and I just... Like, he should have played on the wing or something. He actually play on the wing
at some point? Whatsoever. I feel like he has played
so.
In the back.
I think he
yeah.
did, yeah. He just... I always didn't rate him that highly, but thought he was all right.
Yeah.
But watching this game here, he really, really annoyed me.
Fair enough.
He came off the wing against the Lions in the third test.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
So yeah, so PSVs, whatever. But mentioning the Springboks in the 22, they then have another chance around 65 minutes in the Australian 22, where they have a bunch of phases, and the whole time I was just thinking, set up for the drop goal. Take the drop goal as soon as possible.
Yeah.
And they don't. They get turned over.
Yeah.
James O'Connor manages to clear it. But then Pat Lambie, who's covering from fullback, and this is the point I mentioned in the first half, where Australia do not chase. Maybe it's partly because the winger was the one kicking, but Australia have basically no chase whatsoever following up.
Yeah.
If Lambie ran that back, he gets up to about 50 metres from the try line.
Yeah.
You know? Through losing the ball, South Africa would have lost maybe 5 or 6 metres. Like, you could lose that on a bad carry.
Yeah.
He would have at least made it into the 22. Instead, he goes for a speculative drop goal from the corner, and it's a really good strike, and he comes very, very close.
Tell you what, yeah.
And I think he's
usually
he's
I'm
onto
quite
the right
against
idea.
Them, but I think Lambie's was a good effort. And also, JP Peterson told him to do it. JP Peterson was the one who called it, and he pointed at the post and said, Lambie, go for this. Which, you know, fair play. I think as a winger, it takes quite a lot of balls to do that, because often, as a winger, you know, to say JP Peterson had a lot of ball in hand in this game.
Mm.
It'd be tempting for him to say, yeah, call it to me into the middle and try and have a run and see if he can score a try. But
I feel like they should have crashed that up and then calmly slotted back and taken the free-through stain as he did earlier on.
I get that.
And it was just such an open chance to get back into 22. They could have
so
set it between the post
yeah.
and taken it first, second phase. You know, maybe played one phase with the forwards.
Yeah.
But they didn't. Yeah. They didn't.
Lambie gave it a good go. It was a 20-year-old fullback.
It was... an impressive go, but it felt naive to me.
Sure, I get that. It's really weird that this is the way around we're talking about this, because usually I'm the one who looks at snapdrop goals and says, like, nah, that's ridiculous. And you're going, no, it's fine, it's just a bit of fun. You know, it's usually the other way around that we're talking about this. But yeah, no, I think he gave it a good go, and I don't think it was the wrong option necessarily, but I think you're right. That objectively, it would have been a lot better for him to take a couple of phases over it.
The other thing about this passage as well, right, is the thing I was thinking about the drop goal as well. The Springboks had no real excuse, especially when they'd lost the ball once in that phase already. Mm. Then Foray Dupria turned up and makes this incredible intercept, an inch out from the line, and almost scores.
Oh, yeah. I don't remember that at all.
Yeah.
And that just happened. I was just like, oh, my God, Dupria dropped the ball over the try line.
Yeah. But he takes a hell of a shot.
Yeah.
I think it was Ashley Cooper, maybe?
It
was one of the backs.
I think it was.
Just flies in and nails him, and he loses the ball in contact.
I think Elsamore Psalmi maybe helps him out as well.
A hell of a read, a hell of a hit, and then, you know, he loses the ball.
Genia cleared the ball, didn't he?
O'Connor cleared the ball.
That was so close. It
was almost the match.
Yeah.
And, like, you look at the way New Zealand started to panic more and more the further they got into this competition.
Yeah.
Could the Springboks have beaten them in the semi-final?
Honestly, I have no idea.
You saw how they pushed them in 2015, and I think the Springbok team would have pushed them even harder.
As the Aussies show, if there's a team you don't want to panic against, it's South Africa, right?
Yeah.
And, like, I know that it's a different scale, but the same thing, you know, you look at Fiji and Namibia in the group stage, exactly the same thing happened to them. So it's often the case, you know, with this Springbok team, they will... if your team psychologically struggles, they will just put the foot in the throat and just batter you. And I feel like that you're right, that All Blacks team, if they wilted, the last person they would want to wilt again is the Springboks side.
I feel like there's two realities for the way that semi-final would have gone. One is that New Zealand did what they kind of did against the Wallabies in that semi-final. And that was kind of... They were quite calm for stretches of it, and they scored their tries there. As I remember it, you know, obviously we haven't watched it back. There's a chance the All Blacks would go, okay, this is our real final. We're going to play the Springboks, our oldest rivals, who've beaten us in a World Cup final before, you know, etc. We lost to them earlier this year. We're going to really, really target this game, go all out, and they'd win it in the first half, essentially.
Yeah.
Or the All Blacks would play as they kind of did for a lot of the knockout stages.
Yeah.
And they would try to do that, but they'd throw too many passes. They'd fall off a bit. They'd wobble slightly.
Yeah.
In that case, I think it's a 1 or 2 point game.
Yeah.
And if you've got Mornay Steyn on your team, you've got someone, and you know, as calm as their drop goal drills were and so on, and by the time they got that weird first half against Australia out of their system, if they play like they did in the second half for the full game, that World Cup could have gone very different.
It's so interesting looking at games like this and thinking, because, you know, this is such a good, it's a proper quarterfinal, proper test match, isn't it? It's so interesting seeing, like, the things this can swing on.
But if the All Blacks then lose that semi-final, the next 7 years of international rugby look very, very different.
Yeah, you're right. Because then...
Do the Springboks have their fall-off? Do the All Blacks remain as confident as they
are? This is the home World Cup that they nearly bottled.
Yeah.
You know, and going to 2015, they would have kept that narrative going to England as, oh yeah, we've not won a World Cup since 1987, you know? They would have kept that narrative, and that would have changed that World Cup drastically.
Exactly. They would have had the same level of pressure as they did in 2007 on them in 2015. Not the level in 2011, because that would never happen again. That sheer level of audacious, ridiculous, over-the-top pressure. But there would have been a lot of pressure on what was largely the same squad.
Yeah.
And they probably wouldn't have just completely dominated international rugby in the way they did for 3 years if they'd lost the semi-final.
Because the 2015 team was effectively just a better version of the 2011 team, wasn't it?
Yeah, the 2015 team was the best team of all time.
Yeah.
Like that 2013 through 15 All Blacks is the best team
pretty safe
we've ever seen.
Yeah.
And I didn't quite appreciate it at the time, but I now look back on it and think, oh no, that was as good as it got.
Yeah, you know? I think it was quite easy to get tired of it because it's just like, oh well, they're just beating everyone, aren't they? And it was quite easy to not appreciate the beauty behind it.
Exactly.
But it was easier to
Play against them. For Dupreeh dropping that ball over the line is a proper sliding doors moment.
Yeah, it is.
Like, everything could have gone very,
super
very differently.
Yeah.
Because that was late enough in the game. That was around 65 minutes. That was late enough in the game for Australia to... If Australia then are 6 points down or potentially 8 points down, that changes the way they play, that changes the entire game. That swings things completely. Like, that isn't the same as the knockover penalty or the... even the Lambie try being given before the drop goal, you know, and them going to being pretty much level.
There's not much time left in the game.
No.
There's 10 minutes left. So Berrick Barnes puts this really nice kick into the where the Springboks 22 and forces them to play out. And then the Wallabies do pick up a penalty and for about 40 metres or so. And it's quite speculative, to be honest. Like, you're looking at it, there's a lot of pressure on it.
This was a contentious one in itself.
Yeah.
That after the game... Pienaar was absolutely fuming about this penalty, saying it isn't. I think it's very clearly a penalty.
Yeah, no, I think it's...
So what happens? So the Springboks get a penalty from in their own 22 after the Berrick Barnes kick.
Yeah.
They then... So South Africa clear and Australia's line-up. Sorry, every round. They throw it to Sharp at the front, and as he's bringing the ball down, Victor Matfield grabs the back of his jersey, like the, you know, the back of the neck hole there, and drags him down.
Yeah.
And he's penalised for that. And Francois Pienaar was saying it's just contact in the air. That happens on every line out.
I think it's a penalty.
And I think it's a penalty.
I think also...
Roman Poit's the guy who notices. Bryce Lawrence doesn't give a shit.
Darny Rousseau also tugs at Sharp's foot. He tugs at his leg and brings him off balance. So he falls down on his face. So it is actually kind of dangerous. So I think that is a penalty. My view on it is it's very clearly a penalty. I don't think that was contentious at all.
I agree. But there was a lot of talk about that afterwards. And also, like, that was addressed back to Bryce Lawrence. And, you know, like, the vitriol towards Bryce Lawrence got so bad that he refused to travel to South African referee games there during Super Rugby the following season, which led to him then being dropped from the panel. And that's why he retired from refereeing.
Yeah.
Okay. So he then went on to only refereeing the ITM Cup for a number of years before retiring.
Okay.
Yeah, so he announced retirement in 2012, motivated partly by the reaction to his self-acknowledged poor performance in the 2011 Rugby World Cup quarterfinal.
I didn't know he spoke about this.
I didn't know that until now either. Okay, I should have found this in advance.
No. We'll come on to that. We'll come back to this. Yeah. Okay, so, yeah, James O'Connor slots the penalty. He nails it. It's like 11-9.
Really good kick from 40 metres.
Hell of a good kick. I wasn't expecting him to get it.
Very reminiscent of his one in Hong Kong the previous year.
Yeah.
That of course, starts the incredible movie The Kick.
Yes, of course.
This is not the kick of the title, but it is the kick that starts the whole movie off.
So, yeah, no, it's a hell of a kick. And I was thinking, right, so when he first signalled for goal, I was thinking, like, oh, is this going to be the one? Is this going to be the one that he converts? I was thinking, like, oh, surely this isn't in his range. And he nails it. It's an outstanding kick. Of course, he was coached by that point. He was coached by Bron van Straten, the former Springbok, and just general legend, as far as I can tell, who was the Wallabies kicking coach at this point. You know, brings on the tee for him, who apparently told him to kick off a higher tee, which is why he kicked off that massive blue tee that he had.
Interesting.
Apparently that was Bron van Straten's idea. So, there's a thing for
you. That's a good kicking coach for you, because it worked.
Yeah.
You know, that was the most convincing goal-kicking form of his career, was that sort of 2010, 2011.
Yeah. So, at this point, the box bring on Butch James.
Yes.
Into the midfield for Jean de Villiers. And the second Wallabies kicking option on. Bring on Antfinger, which is confusing.
It was a decision, wasn't it?
So, they bring on Anthony Fayenga at outside centre and move Adam Ashley Cooper to fullback.
Hmm.
By the looks of it, I used to assume that's what they do. They might move O'Connor to fullback with Ashley Cooper on the wing, but I think they put Ashley Cooper at fullback. Yeah, so that's an interesting thing. Don't get me wrong, I don't think Antfinger does anything particularly terrible in this game.
No, but, you know, he had one carry, really. He makes a couple of tackles. Yeah. That's sort of it.
Yeah, but you know, just an interesting call for them to bring on Antfinger after his form so far in the World Cup. And also, he was very injured against the USA, so I was very shocked that he actually managed to come back within like 2 weeks. But no, fair enough. But yeah, so what surprised me here is there's a point where South Africa are on the edge of the Australian half and they're just about creeping in. And you start to think, right, Australia have to be squeaky clean here, you know, because any penalties, Mornay Steyn's knocking this over from 50 yards. But instead, the Wallabies are really playing on the edge and they're really like contesting every breakdown. And that really, really shocks me that they're going for that. Because I was thinking, like, right, you leave every breakdown, you trust your line speed, you try and push them into touch, you do something, hope they make a mistake.
Lawrence has been so loose on it. And the other thing he's really hot, the one thing the Wallabies do, the Springboks do pick up and the Wallabies were doing early on, is that he's really open to someone flying over the top to try and bother the nine.
Mm.
And that happens a lot, someone rushing almost offside through that. And he's very soft on the offside line as well.
Yeah.
And the Springboks notice that and start doing it, and then both teams start putting extra blockers in place in the ruck.
Yeah.
But that's the one thing, and the Wallabies do try and do that a few times during this phase, as you say, where they're really flying up and they're really challenging the breakdown.
Yeah.
But they keep getting away with it. You know, if you've got David Pocock and Rocky Elson, use David Pocock and Rocky Elson.
But what interestingly then happens, I mean, Pat Lambie fluffs a line as it looks like they've potentially got an attacking opportunity. But then James Horwell somehow gets away with a very high tackle on Dani Rousseau. I have no idea.
Round the neck, and the thing is, it forms into a maul.
Yeah.
And it becomes a choke tackle. And the whole time the arm is round the neck.
Yeah.
It's not that it slips up.
It's not
up
dangerous,
and it slips back down.
Necessarily.
It's not, no, but it's absolutely round the neck.
It's a penalty, yeah.
And even back then, commentators were saying that's high
fine.
Tackle.
Yeah. It's
and there's
not
quite a few high tackles
technical.
And stuff that people get away with. And that is, but that is very clearly a high tackle.
Yeah.
And I said, like, it's not like it slips up or down. It's there the whole time, yeah. And instead, they win the ball back for it.
Yeah. Well, Genia puts in a lovely kick, 76 minutes in, which just wastes
such a
minute.
Kick.
And he just basically gets it to sit up in the in-goal area. So South Africa to ground and go for 22. It's one of the most inconvenient ways to play out, isn't it?
Perfectly weighted to sit up just on the try line.
Yeah.
Like, it bounces up like the blade of grass before the try line. And Genia knows no matter which way it bounces, that is working out.
I think
best,
he would
right?
have actually preferred it to bounce over to get the 22,
well,
then South Africa have to play it.
It's... whichever way it goes, it's worked out perfectly for the Wallabies. Either it goes into touch, it runs down the clock, and they've
so
got to play
smart,
out from a line out. It bounces up, and Lambie has to play it from his own try line.
Yeah.
Or it bounces back, and they've got to take the dropout because it's not got enough on it to go dead.
The 22 dropout
is
the most
such a
awkward way. The most awkward thing to have on the 79th minute of a match if you're trying to win it.
You're kicking back to the opposition. You've got to align your defence really weirdly.
Yeah.
And your attack as well, I guess. But you're either giving the ball back or you're trapping yourself in the 22 with an opposition really on the defense really on the front foot.
Yeah,
if you do the gamble,
that is a world class.
There's no way to win there.
Who
Gargania was knows incredible.
He knows his stuff. Like it's such a smart kick, isn't it? So South Africa do get turnover that you alluded to earlier.
Jacques Berger comes in illegal.
After his leaving party. He's there with his sombrero on and his cigar, and he goes, "Oh,
we want to give the Wallabies a really good game."
Yes, yeah, yeah, exactly. No, Scott Berger
completely illegal, off his feet, sealing every law. He looks over the law book and he goes, "How many of these can I break?" You know, the Wallabies have spent the entire game breaking every single breakdown law imaginable. Pocock has broken them all in order, in sequence. I'm going to try and do them all at once.
Yeah.
And Berger goes in, he breaks every single law, he comes up with a ball, and he pops it back, and the Springboks get a chance.
It's only fair,
and Lawrence goes,
right?
Play on. Yeah, exactly.
Lawrence puts his arms in the air and goes, fuck it, why not?
Yeah, like, spectacle, innit? Spectacle. Better game. Better game. You know, no one wants to see teams grinding it down for the last minute.
No, exactly. Yeah. But yeah, I think South Africa really, really find their shape here. And I think it's a super interesting attack because at this point, the Wallabies finally do leave it. I think the contrast from that, between that and 5 minutes earlier, when they were contesting everything and just thinking like, right, if Pocock really can come up with a match-winning play here, we can kick into their half and see what happens. But this time, they're just thinking, oh shit, no, if we give anything away. Like, because every single referee, whether you're Bryce Lawrence, whether you're Steve Walsh, whether you're Luke Pearce refereeing the Wales-France match at the end of the Six Nations 2021, every referee will look out for these things so much more in the last minute, right?
Yeah.
So David Pocock could do something that he's gotten away with 20 times already in this game, and this time Bryce Lawrence will penalise him. So Australia as a pack know they're going to leave the breakdown and wait for South Africa to make a mistake. 50 metres is a long way to go, but if you give away a penalty, it's one kick.
Yeah.
It's one kick for Mornay Steyn to knock that over. And as we alluded to earlier, like, he is more than capable of doing that. As you say, yeah, they start off 65 metres out and they make these metres so rapidly.
They get right, as you say, they really find their shape.
Super
efficient.
Yeah.
It's possibly the best attacking set of phases they put together in the game. Is in that last minute.
Yeah, one of the best.
Largely because the Wallabies are so much slower, you know, in their defence. Like, they're being so much more conservative.
Yeah.
Just not because they don't want to give a penalty away because, you know, they're going out the World Cup, but they do.
Yeah.
South Africa get up to 40 metres out. Like, they're pretty much between the posts, 40 metres out, and there is a high tackle. There is a very clear high tackle that is not penalised. And you can say, hey, it's consistency because both teams have got away with high tackles.
Yeah.
But at the same time, this one was even slightly more vicious than the Hall one earlier. But nothing is given.
Yeah.
And the South Africa then play, you know, a few more phases and they keep
even
going.
Even ignoring that, you're thinking 20 metres and they're in drop goal range. Not even 20 metres, 10 metres and Mornay Steyn can stop this, you know. I think we've seen both of the Steyns, I was about to call them the Steyn brothers, they're not brothers, but we've seen them drop goals from anywhere within 50 metres.
You look at Mornay Steyn's second cap, right? It's his second cap. He knocks over the winner from halfway against the Lions to win the series.
Yeah.
Like, that is in his blood. It's what he loves more than anything else, is kicking last-minute winners. That is what he lives for.
Yeah.
He would have dreamt of that his entire life, kicking his goal like that in the last minute of a walk-up.
I think you've said the same thing about Dan Bigger before, but the more pressure there is on the kick, the more likely Mornay Steyn is to nail it. And almost the further away from the goalposts he is, the further he can boot it, you know?
Yeah. I will never see a last minute kick that I wouldn't back either Bigger or Steyn to get.
Right. If that was the All Blacks or frankly any other team in the top eight in the quarterfinals of this who was playing against Australia, it would play out differently because the Wallabies probably could have.
Yeah.
You know, so 2013 Lions, the second test, the Lions are in the same situation. They're 2 points down. They're attacking. They're 50 metres out. Ben Moen gives away a penalty on the halfway line, knowing it is an inch outside of Lee Halfpenny's range. Halfpenny misses the Wallabies win the test match. You could do that.
Yeah,
and Pocock probably would. If this was against, say, England or whatever, even Wales, right?
If it was England, they'd have wrapped it up by half-time. But sure,
yeah, sure.
On.
But if this was against anybody else, they would know. If they give away that penalty, then it will be inches out of the person's range. They'll probably just about miss it and you get away with it, right? But, you know, with South Africa, Mornay Steyn, as long as he's in the opposition half, he is going to nail whatever kick he's given.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. He's got about 55 metres in which you think he could hit this.
Yeah.
And it's not worth the risk.
No. So they leave everything. And as you say, they keep playing. And eventually Morne Steyn knocks the ball on.
It's really unlucky. It's a poor pass that Steyn yeah. knocks on the floor trying to regather. Yeah.
And it's kind of law of averages.
Because it passes backwards and you have a moment phases. Of... It's one of the... It's like the news being broken to you slowly because the ball is fumbled backwards and then Steyn knocks it on the floor and you have a moment of relief followed by, oh no, yeah. you know? It's like a match-winning try being decided by the TMO.
I couldn't help but cheer for the Springboks in that last play, you know?
Yeah.
And hope that... Because, it's one of those that, right, after all of both teams have been through, whoever gets more points on the day deserves to win.
Exactly. It was a really, really level game.
Yeah.
The Wallabies defended extremely, extremely well.
Yeah.
And that was the thing, again, Pinot was saying after the game, was he was just saying, actually, they defended better than the Wallabies. The Wallabies defended better than the Springboks did anything else.
Yeah.
So they deserve to win.
And it's one of those things that, obviously, the referee is a big factor, but as Francois Pinot said, they should have been further ahead. So Will Genny kicks the ball out, and that's full time. It's 11-9. It's controversial.
Australia made almost exactly 100 tackles more than the Springboks.
Okay,
right, but that is
that's a lot.
And they both have the same tackle completion.
I was gonna question this because the tackle completion rate was so high, and there were so many tackles from both teams flying in. The ball and play time must have been insane.
The tackle completion was 93% each.
Wow. Okay.
The Springboks made 54 of 59. The Wallabies made 152 of 164.
Okay. Wow, that's pretty special. That's again a hell of a test match. It's a really really physical game.
The Wallabies also conceded more penalties. Yeah. There you go. 4-5, which is not that high.
No.
But actually the point is that they got away with an awful lot.
Yeah. No,
so, because they played far more.
They played the referee a bit better. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's... Me saying they played the referee better sounds like such a bullshit claim, because the amount of times you have it where people at amateur rugby level claim, you know, if you mouth back to the referee, you're not playing the referee well, you know, which is true, but...
Yeah.
At international level, you shouldn't be making claims like that. But
exactly.
They played the referee so well to the point at which, as you said earlier, they've had him four times this year. David Pocock knew what he could get away with and exactly how to get away with it to the exact positioning of the referee and the positioning on the field of where he is, of when to try this. Which
and
is a world-class open soft flanker.
Kicked the ball a lot. So they played for territory because they knew they could cheat at the breakdown.
Yeah.
You know? If you knew you could cheat at the breakdown, you know you're going to get points when you get into the opposition half.
Yeah.
Be it a lucky try like they got through Horwell, be it, you know, the two penalties they did get, or be it, you know, any other chances they were given.
Yeah.
Because you're just going to create that. So the Wallabies had 33% possession, but they kicked more times than the Springboks. They kicked 38 times to 33.
Right.
That's the kind of stat that tells you everything,
yeah.
right? That yes, they had less territory, but it was their decision to. Less
sure.
possession, but it was their decision to.
Yeah.
They wanted to play territory.
To, yeah.
That was what they wanted to do. That was how they figured they'd win this game.
Yeah. Okay. So, do you want to look at that thing of Bryce Lawrence talking about the game?
Yeah. The one other thing is when the full-time whistle goes, when Genia kicks it out after the knock-on, Adam Ashley Cooper in midfield absolutely loses his shit.
Really? I missed that.
And then he just starts jumping up and down and punching the air. And then you can hear, I think it's him, but it could be someone else, on what I think is the ref mic, making howler monkey noises. You're like, It's incredible.
Fair play.
It's worth looking up just for that.
Yeah.
just
I will say, actually, before we move on to the Bryce Lawrence thing, this is a really good game. And
it's a really good game.
It's worth people watching this, I think, because it, for the controversy, if nothing else, you know.
If you're into low-scoring games, you know, like the Six Nations final, the Women's Six Nations the other week.
Yeah.
If you enjoyed that, this is exactly that kind of game.
Yeah, this is
a game that is tense, it's tight, and
comes down to
every
the
decision
margins.
Matters.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's a really, really good test match. And honestly, if you're South African, you might not want to rewatch it. But I think if we have any Australian listeners or whatever, then it's a fascinating watch. So I'd recommend, you know, I'd love to hear what people think of it. You know, drop us a tweet or whatever. I'd love to hear what Australians or South African fans who might have listened to this think.
No,
or anyone
please,
who's rewatched
yeah.
it.
So... Okay, so Bryce Lawrence retired, claiming political pressure forced him out.
Okay.
I went into the quarterfinal knowing it was a massive match and I didn't want to overly influence the outcome. The way that transpired was I didn't make decisions, and if I had my time again, I would go out there and do what I do normally, which is just referee and back myself.
Okay.
So you're saying basically I didn't want to give penalties, I was afraid to give penalties.
Okay, right. Which so it was a personal thing
something.
Of... You know, I didn't want
he's
to.
He's saying this now.
I didn't want to ruin the game, sort of thing.
By this point, he'd spent almost 2 years reflecting on it, clearly.
Right.
So he's probably been looking over that over and over again. He's
that, no doubt he's been watched this year and thought about that. Bless it. Like, it's difficult. He's human, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't think he was quite as bad as people have maybe made out. I just think...
Yeah.
I think that he had as big an impact on the game as people make out. But I don't think, as you say, I don't think it was a fault of his own.
Mm, yeah. I had four really good group games at the World Cup, and then I had that. I had outside pressure from pretty senior people from rugby countries behind the scenes that really created my mindset of lacking confidence to deliver what I normally do.
Oh, that's interesting.
There was some pretty nasty political stuff going on around that appointment, with some big people kicking up a massive stink. It probably made me freeze on the biggest stage. Are we saying that's the same sort of pressure we're talking about earlier of why is a New Zealand referee deciding who
it might be something
plays
like,
the All Blacks?
That was my immediate thought, that it would be something like that.
I was told I'd be brought back in the middle of the year, but they... Oh, okay, this was... So after that game, he was informed that it was suggested he should take a break from Test rugby.
Okay.
He then said, I was told I'd be brought back in the middle of the year, but they dropped me because of pressure from the unions like Australia and South Africa behind the scenes, and that is the reason for my career change, all because of one game.
Wow. That's quite harrowing to hear that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because it sounds like he was quite personally affected by something somebody had said during the group stages. And then clearly somebody must have kicked up a fuss about him getting that game in the first place. So he felt like he had to referee it in a certain way, and that's ultimately cost him his career as a referee.
Yeah.
That's really quite harrowing to hear about that. And I know that, and I totally understand this, that a lot of people won't have much remorse about that, you know, because they feel they'll feel robbed, you know. So that's, you know, as I say, we've said this countless times, we're Welsh fans talking about the 2011 World Cup. Of course we're going to feel bitter as well.
Yeah, and like, I do look back on how we treated, and I suppose we'll get onto this in another episode, but Alan Rowland, and feel actually that was terrible, you know. Like, actually that was... It's one thing to boo him the next time he referees at the Millennium Stadium, but the level of vitriol he must have received and abuse and, you know, being this joke that is still a household name in the country almost 10 years later, because of one decision that was actually entirely fair when you look back on it. That it's very easy to get caught up in that, and it's something I've learnt with time and why I've always had the policy on the channel, and obviously I've had to break it for this one game of not talking about refereeing decisions. I think rugby is genuinely a better game when you stop worrying about that
and you stop
looking at that and you accept the referee's decision as final, which is in the laws of the game. You know, that is a law, is the referee's decision is always final. And I think rugby is better when you focus on everything else around it. And it's too easy because, you know, because everyone gets caught up in that idea of laws versus rules and people being, you know, pernickety about the wording of that. But they are laws because they're there for interpretation.
Yeah.
And the referee is put in place as the person to interpret the laws on that day.
Yeah.
And they're never going to be perfect. And that's why, you know, you can't have a robot refereeing a rugby game. That's why, you know, the best referees are those that have empathy and speak to. And, you know, often Nigel Owens, when he was the best referee in the world for those years, would often ignore laws or change laws and alter laws and play in his own way. But both teams were very clear on how the game was being refereed and what was going on. And it led to great spectacles. It led to really, really good...
I mentioned Luke Pearce earlier. Like,
he's Luke Pearce, perfect example.
I mean, other than Wayne Barnes, he's probably the best referee in the world at the moment. Because he has a very clear interpretation of how he will play the laws. And they might not always be uber consistent, but the players will have some kind of knowledge or understanding around that and a respect for it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, yes, it's very easy to shout at the referee, and, you know, I was guilty of it about the time, but also, like, you know, I was like 16.
Anyone who's ever ref me knows that I hate all referees, right?
Yes. But I find that you can have a debate about refereeing decisions, and sometimes you will naturally.
Yeah.
But
sometimes it's
more interesting.
Fun part of sport. Sometimes.
Sure. Yeah. I find it's more interesting to actually look at the intricacies of the game.
Yeah, and the skills and the tactical bits. Yeah.
And since I made that kind of conscious decision to ignore referees and to, you know, kind of just go, okay, they've done that, there's nothing I can do that would change it in campaigning or complaining, you start to notice more and you start to pick up on more bits and you start to, you know, like go, oh, actually that thing that team's doing is interesting, you know, the way they're defending is interesting, the way they're setting up their pods and they're playing, you know, they're playing this shape differently to last week. You start to notice more, you start to pay attention to more, you start to take in more, because all that attention goes somewhere else that you were previously taking into just being angry. And just being pointlessly angry at a man just doing his job is no way to live your life.
Yeah. So no, I mean, my sympathies are with Bryce Lawrence, to be honest, after hearing all of that, because I get that these people are personally affected by other things that aren't happening in the 80 minutes worth of a game of rugby, you know, because it's easy to look at that and think, oh yeah, these are human beings, but they're not just human beings for the 80 minutes that they're refereeing, are they? You know, they are for the weeks around that and the years that surpass after that. So fair play to Bryce Lawrence fronting up and talking about that afterwards. You know, I'm sure that eventually he'll talk about that again, and there might be more stuff that he has to get off his chest eventually. But no, fair play to him. I mean, again, I get that some people will be less forgiving than I am, and that's
I get that.
That's justified because you'll feel like you missed out on a World Cup, and that's
You look at it; he was incredibly loose with the breakdown.
He was,
and yes, I think he was consistent in how he did it, but he didn't referee the breakdown.
And Australia exploited
the tournament.
That.
Did
yeah,
yeah. He refereed it in a consistent way for this game, but not consistent the rest of the tournament.
Yeah.
And South Africa were on the losing side of that because Australia had been exposed to that consistently for a year.
Yeah, exactly.
And there was a level of unfairness there. I think we're probably going in circles now.
We are. Let's do Man of the Match and Dick of the Day.
Move on to... Yeah. Thank you.
Do you want to start with Dick of the Day?
Okay. My Dick of the Day is Piers Spies because he's shit.
So I had three nominations. One of them is Kurtley Beale for missing, clipping John de Villiers around the ear.
Oh, yeah.
Another one was Antfinger for coming on. He didn't do anything particularly bad.
I didn't think about that.
It's just his Antfinger.
Give him a break.
You know, yeah. But my Dick of the Day is also Piers Spies because he, at one point, decided to try and pick and go from a scrum on a 5-metre blindside on the left-hand side and got pushed into touch.
Yeah.
Which
that was one of the facts.
Is
that,
a fine margin to do
that was the moment I decided he was my Dick of the Day. I'd just been annoyed about that and the clear-out that I mentioned where he didn't bother clearing out. And I thought, you know what? He is the Dick of the Day to me.
Interesting, and we both went for Piers Spies. That's quite good.
Yeah,
honourable mention for Antfinger because I love that guy.
Bless him. Bless Antfinger. No, I'm very proud of him. He's finally gone to Australia again.
Yeah,
he's finally played
the
game where he isn't Dick of the Day.
Is this
the
first time he's made it through a game without getting Dick of the Day?
It's the first time he's played a game in this World Cup without getting Dick of the Day.
That's pretty phenomenal, to be fair.
So, good on him, man. Yeah. Good on him. I think he's currently top of the leaderboard for Dick of the Days as well.
Right. We'll come on to that in a later episode, of course.
Hey, Martin Rodriguez has got a game to go.
Yes, of course. Of course, I forgot about that. Quickly, man of the match.
Yes. I mean, okay, I said at the start, there are two contenders. James Hall plays very, very well, but for me, it's between Will Genia and David Pocock. Will Genia, I thought, was phenomenal, kicked really, really well. Controlled. It was in terms of controlling a game. That is exactly how you do it. That's a masterclass. But the man of the match in this game is David Pocock, and I won't accept any other answers.
Okay, that's an entirely fair call. So I think, first off, Morley Stone and John de Villiers, I think both played really, really well for South Africa. Mm-hmm. I think they both made life hard for Australia a lot of times. But again, Dan Vickerman, I think, was excellent. I think he locked everything down so, so well. I think he was really important. Radiki Samo, likewise. I think he picked up a lot of scraps, sent Australia forward. But the man of the match just is David Pocock. We've spoken about him so much. I think about 40% of this podcast audio is just going to be the word Pocock. So yeah, my man of the match is, I'll say it one more time, and this will be the last time I say it, Pocock, David.
The thing you said earlier, right, is that South Africa on top on almost every attribute, every part of the game, except for the breakdown.
Yeah.
And that is entirely because of David, the word that
surname
we
redacted.
We banned.
Yeah.
Yes.
The first coming of Michael Hooper.
The third coming of George Smith. Yes, so... Oh, I think that's it, isn't it?
An hour and 50 minutes we've been talking for.
Yeah, that's been the longest one we've done.
Yeah, by some stretch. That was a heavy episode, but...
There was a lot to get into. We almost exclusively talked about rugby as well, which is a rare...
Necessary, I think. That was a very important episode.
Knockout game so far, we've basically only talked about rugby. It's really
weird. It is, isn't it? I'm sure that'll change next week when we have the return of Martin Rodriguez. And again,
because the next game is New Zealand 33, Argentina 10.
So this is a good one. I think this is a fun episode, I think. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it. It's coming up. That'll be with you next week. In the meantime, please have a wonderful time. And whatever you're doing, just be David Pocock.
And don't forget to congratulate me on my inevitable Lions call up.
Oh, yeah. Congratulations to Marcus Smith on the highlight of his career. I know your mum's very proud.
Okay. Goodbye. I'll see you next week.
Bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free.
or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.